House Committee on State and Federal Affairs is open on Friday, the 29th, at about 9:07. The first item today will be a hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 152. I'd like to first call Representative Krieger. And staff, if you could give us a brief explanation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. Senate Bill 152, and you should have the A engrossed version, passed the Senate floor on a vote of 27-0, would authorize issuance of up to $10 million of lottery bonds for grants to finance construction of a passenger terminal at the North Bend Airport. Those funds are split between this biennium and next biennium, $6 million in the first biennium, $4 million in the second biennium. Senate amended the bill to require documentation that the district will have sufficient funding to complete the project before the bonds are issued, because this doesn't fund the whole project. Establishes the dates that bonds will be deposited and establishes a North Bend Airport Improvement Fund. Mr. Chair, there is a fiscal and revenue impact statement at your place, and the bill does have a subsequent referral to the Budget Committee.
Thank you. Just the call, please. Mr. Chair, please.
Okay. Michelle Barker. I thought it was fitting today to give you an opportunity to wield the gavel in this committee, because you did such a fine job in judiciary, so I appreciate you doing that for us.
Thank you.
I'm Wayne Krieger, a state rep for District 1, which covers all of Curry County, about 70% of Coos County, and western Douglas from Winston down Highway 42 to the county line. I'm here today to ask for your support for the North Bend Airport project. I met with Gary Letelier, manager of the North Bend Airport, in early January 2005, along with Representative Roebling, and we were briefed as to the need for the project and its projected positive impact for the South Coast. The briefing was informative, complete, and I felt that the funding could be secured. If funding could be secured, it would be a huge benefit to the South Coast and the people in our economy. I met with Speaker Menace in mid-January and discussed the project and its value to the South Coast and our people. Her first question to me is, how can I help? I told her I needed $10 million and that the project was my number one priority for this legislative session, and that position as being my number one priority has never changed or wavered. I would like to have some way of describing the look on her face other than a smile when I asked for $10 million the first 2 weeks of the biennium, when we hadn't have a balanced budget and we didn't really know where we were, but she didn't tell me no. And if someone doesn't tell you no, that's encouraging, and we've continued to work forward from that point. The airport project is an integral part of the infrastructure that drives the economy of the South Coast. We believe that the completion of the natural gas pipeline will spur development. Development could bring more people to the area, and additional need for the airport for transportation and shipping. The possibility of a liquid gas terminal project is being brought forward. Two ships per month could use the facility there in Coos Bay, which would be, I believe, about a $660 million investment if that comes into fruition. A new mill at this time is being constructed on the North Spit, and a new rail spur is in progress. All of this infrastructure are linked together and will help create jobs on the South Coast. This bill and project can best be described as jobs present and future and business opportunity. I want to speak to you just a minute, because I don't believe Mr. Hickoff has arrived, has he? And he is the manager of Bandon Dunes, which is a huge driver to this project on the South Coast. I want to talk just a little bit about some of the things that are taking place there, which I, you know, if someone would have asked me to invest in this pile of sand with some scrubby trees as an investment, I would have, you know, I probably would have said no. As of June 1, the staff at Bandon Dunes is 460 full-time employees. About 95% of them are coming from the South Coast. There's also 325 caddies. About 50% of those are from the area, and their tips can run from anywhere from $100 to $200 a day just in tips. 65% of the customers from away from the Northwest, not included in that number, are those coming from British Columbia, Washington, Montana, Idaho, California, Oregon, Bandon, and Bandon Dunes is known worldwide. Golfers come from Asia, Europe, and in reality from all over the world and around the United States. There are four flights a day which plane that total 30 Boeing passengers or more, and there could be as high as 12 landings daily at a later date. There have been as many as 30 to 31 planes on the tarmac waiting and being parked in overcrowded conditions. There are presently, as of the 1st of June, three 18-hole golf courses with both seasonal rates of winter off-season and summer rates. They also have a 55-acre practice area. They're seen to have 219 overnight accommodations and four restaurants. They're on construction for another $20 million for the South Coast. They'll have their first international event, the Curtis Cup, in 2006 and 2007. It's planned to have a U.S. mid-amateur. They presently have had 55,000 room nights this last year, 60,000 visitors last year, and about 105,000 rounds of golf on three courses. And they are planning for an additional two courses, up to 300 overnight rooms, making service for making additional employment. Bandon Dunes, in fact, and their employees are helping drive the South Coast economy, and it's very much necessary to proceed with the North Bend Airport to accommodate just the growth from Bandon Dunes, not considering other things that will be described by others that are going to be testifying in a few moments. This project is not about Senator Cruz. It's not about Senator Verger. It's not about Representative Roblin, and it's not about Representative Krieger. It's about our economy and the opportunity for the future. It is economic development, family wage jobs, and the ability of the people to live and raise their families on the South Coast. I was hoping that Mr. Hickok could be here because he gave the presentation so much better than I did on the Bandon Dunes, but it is really hugely valuable to employment for our people. There's a lot of single moms that work out there and people that have transcended out of fisheries and forestry that work out there. If most of those people have insurance, and even the ones that are on the low end of the wages are in the type of professions that their tips are very high, so it's very good for our area. Shortly, Mr. Letelier, the North Bend Airport Manager, will be briefly describing the airport project and answering any questions that you have. I'm going to leave everything else to the other senators and representatives that are going to speak in a moment, but I ask that you listen carefully. It's a huge driver. I think when you see and hear what they have to say, you'll agree that it's a project that needs to be funded.
Any questions? I just want to say I want to thank you personally for your efforts. We all know from reading even the newspaper this thing was getting sidetracked in a political way that was unnecessary, and you stepped up and were able to take people down there and show them on the scene, and really you deserve a lot of credit for really saving the day on this one. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, if I can have Representative Roblin, Senator Verger, and Senator Cruz. Please go ahead in any order you'd like.
Yes.
Good morning, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Joanne Verger, Oregon State Senator from District 5. You're going to hear a lot about the project, and so what I'd like to just focus on this morning is first my thanks to the Speaker, Representative Krieger, those involved. This is a day that we've all looked forward to. Then I'd like to say that this bill was not a bill that was brought just by some outside influence. This bill was born out of the community. It was born right there on the South Coast. While all of us here in the legislature, including former Senator Ken Messerly, have had this as a top priority for us, it is the people of the South Coast that have been pushing. They voted to form an airport district. They have been totally supportive of the airport and the infrastructure that leads to the betterment of the economy on the South Coast. And I am indebted to those who have worked very hard in the community and also to the airport board who have sought funds at other places and sought assistance from the local community before they came to the state. This was not an effort of just coming to you with a handout. This was an effort of doing much work, and they'll refer to that in their presentation of how much they have accumulated in funds before they ever came asking for $10 million. Keep in mind that this is a community effort from people from their own homes in the South Coast who are looking forward to your decision. Thank you very much.
My name is Representative Bonnie Roblin. I'm a representative from Coos Bay, District 9. I'm here. This is a really important bill for all of us on the economy of the South Coast. And I want to give a little bit of history because I think sometimes people don't understand how much a community who is in dire economic times is willing to put forward to keep a project going. I've got involved with economic development in our area in a group called FONSI, Friends for New and Sustainable Energy. A bunch of business people came together and said, we need to start talking as one voice in the South Coast, not Coos Bay, North Bend, Bandon, Brookings, all of the other places, but can we get together and start having discussions about how do we help the economy in the South Coast? One of the first things that happened back in 98 was the understanding that the North Bend Airport was having some real financial difficulties with the new requirements that were required with respect to fire coverage and so on, and the affordability of it for the city of North Bend. So this group took upon itself to start working with local community members to see, is there some other way we could have the management of the airport happen? And it so happened that the Port of Coos Bay stepped forward and said, you know, it could be under our port district. We'd be willing to do that. We need to pass a bond to get some extra money to help us do that, but we would be willing. And FONSI took that on, and the local people voted taxes on themselves to keep this airport functioning and moved the management to the Port of Coos Bay. That continued, and it was still a difficult thing for the port to do, and so the community again rose and said, you know, we can make the first, I think may still be the only, airport district, and we would be willing to do that. So we had a county vote, and the county made a new district called the Coos Bay North Bend Airport District, and you will hear from them a little later. Again, it has its own tax base. The people were willing, even though the economy is tough, to support the issue that we had to have this valuable part of the infrastructure for the South Coast. That continues to today, and I think Representative Krieger did a great job in explaining about Bandon Dunes, but just to note, Bandon Dunes is ahead of schedule. They weren't expecting to have this third course. They ended up having so much success that it continued to grow. Well, that growth has also meant that the 20-year projected progress of our airport, and you'll hear more about that, was exceeded already. So the need to expand and to get more space both on the tarmac for parking planes as well as separating the terminal became more and more urgent as time went on. And this is a part of an economic development strategy for the whole South Coast. A rail spur that's going out to the North Spit, where the sawmill that Representative Krieger was talking about is being built, and we hope and anticipate a liquid natural gas storage facility will be sited, are all part of what we hope to have real family wage jobs coming back to the South Coast, which will help in all of the different economic issues. Our declining schools, the other kinds of things that are happening in the South Coast can be alleviated through this kind of investment from the state. The community has stepped forward and invested a lot of their money through taxes and others to keep the airport going. And what we're asking for here is that the state contribute to that. The state has been a major player in our South Coast from the natural gas pipeline to, we hope, the North Bend Airport. And I appreciate the opportunity. I too want to thank Representative Krieger. I've been talking with him and working with him all session. I know that he has made this a priority, and I appreciate all the work that he has done. So thank you for your time today.
Good morning. For the record, State Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, half of my Senate district is Representative Krieger's district, and we have worked rather diligently on this as well as other issues. From a historical perspective, I've represented the coast now clear since January. But I've been in the legislature since 97, and there was another freshman at that point in time by the name of Ken Messerly, who was a freshman in the House. And there tends to be a bonding sometimes of those folks that are part of the other Oregon. That would be the Oregon outside the Willamette Valley. And so it was very easy when Ken started talking about the economy of the coast and the infrastructure needs of that economy and the need to make the Port of Coos Bay a viable deep water port. It was very easy for me, representing Southern Oregon, to see the connection. How that economic development on the coast would have a direct and positive impact on the economies in my part of the state. And of course, now the coast is my part of the state. So it's been kind of a natural evolution. But I want to give Ken Messerly a lot of credit, because it was in 97 we started working on these issues from the pipeline. You got to look at the things you need to have. You need to have infrastructure. The gas pipeline, the upgrade of the electrical system, upgrade of the airport, upgrade of the rail system, work on the port itself. I mean, there's a lot of things that need to come together, and it takes a good period of time to do that. And so this has been a continual effort here in the legislature since 97 to put the pieces in place to benefit all of Southern Oregon. Now, Bandon Dunes is in my district, and I think at some point in time we need to take a group of legislators out there for a fact-finding tour. At this point, it'd take 3 days, wouldn't it? So, and I think that would be beneficial. I played Bandon Dunes once a long time ago when they had 118 and the clubhouse wasn't even done, and it was beyond belief. And the quality of that golf course. I mean, it blew me away. And it's now a worldwide destination. You know, we need to be able to get the people there. And this airport upgrade is an absolutely vital component on a lot of levels. Number one, if you look at the requirements under Homeland Security, it doesn't comply. The new terminal is absolutely essential for us to have compliance. The rules have changed. This would allow the airport to change with those rules and to meet the standards. But I guess I really want to say that this isn't an end-all be-all for the economy of the South Coast, but it is such a vital component along with everything else that we have put in place and everything else we will put in place in the future. And we need to keep this moving forward. You know, when the state of Oregon went into a recession, it was hard for those of us in Southern Oregon and on the coast to really recognize that, because we've been in recession for over a decade. Our ability to make livings the way we always had been greatly diminished. And it's exciting to see the way folks have picked themselves up and are trying to be innovative and create new opportunities, new industries, and that's certainly happening on the coast. The vitality of the people and the communities on the coast is amazing at this point in time. We need to, as a state, to do what we can to assist them and to keep them moving forward. And for us not to step up in this minor way to help, I think could potentially have a devastating impact. Keep in mind, this is the other Oregon. And I think it is so wonderful that the state is now recognizing parts of the other Oregon and stepping up to help. So this bill, did we have any opposition in the Senate?
Unanimous.
More than that. You know, of course, we're such a convivial body over there. Nobody disagrees on anything in the Senate, but This is not a partisan issue. This is not a political issue. This is economic development. Job one of this legislature should be economic development, so I urge passage of this bill.
Okay. Any questions, committee members? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to have Claire Jones, Sue Richardson, and Gary Letalier come up, please.
Identify yourself. Chairman Krieger and members of the committee, I'm Claire Jones, chairman of the Coos County Airport District. I'd like to introduce Susan Richardson, who is our vice chairman, and she will be making a few statements, and Mr. Gary Letalier, who is our director of the airport. I just would like to say one thing in listening to the previous testimony. Our board really supports Senator Berger, Representative Krieger, Representative Arnie Roblin, Senator Cruz. They have given us so much support for this airport that we just couldn't hardly believe it. So anyway, we discussed that privately and how well this has been going, and like to thank you for that. Susan?
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Sue Richardson. I am the vice chair of the Coos County Airport District, and we are pleased to be here today. We and appreciate the opportunity to submit this testimony into the record. I would just like to echo a couple of things that Chair Krieger and Senator Berger have already mentioned, that we feel this is a really strong and our best bet at some revitalization support for the Coos County, the North Bend Airport. Transportation infrastructure is clearly a limiting factor at this point for economic development on the South Coast. We have wonderful things going, as Representative Krieger outlined, and the airport should be a part of that. The airport should be part of what's making and supporting and helping the wonderful things happen. And in fact, it's a limiting factor at this point because of the limitations of size and capability. And that's what we're hoping to get some state help with to change and improve the airport so that it can be a positive factor in economic development on the South Coast as opposed to the limiting factor which it currently is. And this airport has been professionally run and managed for a number of years. Projections have been done on use and needs in terms of the airport. A lot of work has already been accomplished in terms of the runway systems and other infrastructure pieces. Projections, of course, were developed as they would be for any well-run business. As Representative Krieger said, we're outstripping the projections at a very rapid rate due to factors outside our control. We are already way beyond where we projected we'd be 5 years from now. So we need to be able to shift gears and be in a stronger position to deal with the kinds of growth and the kinds of work and jobs and use that's happening in the Coos Bay area. And the new terminal we see as the key to that. The other piece I'd especially like to mention, and I think Senator Berger touched on this particularly, has to do with that this is not just something the Airport District Board sat down and thought of and said, oh, let's see if we can get $10 million from somebody. You know, this is a project that's had serious support in the community, as Representative Roblin said, for years. And it was evidenced most recently last year in 2004 when Governor Kulongowski asked us to and blessed us as an Oregon Solutions project. And this was a group of community members, elected representatives, and agency folks that sat down and worked together through defining the problem and coming up with solutions and recommendations. And the legislation you see before you is a direct result of some of the work that was done by that Oregon Solutions team. So this is not an isolated or kind of single entity kind of initiative. It's very much a part of something that the whole community and representatives of the whole community are putting forward. Again, in terms of the partnership, it's the funding piece is coming from a variety of spots, and again, this is the partnership aspect. $3 million has been appropriated at the federal congressional level for a new air traffic control facility, which is a key part of this development. We have programmed over $10 million for more runway work from the FAA. There are other sources of income and support for this project, as noted in the table in the back of the charts in the back of the testimony. So it's not that people are just standing up and saying, yes, we support this. They're putting their money where their mouth is. They understand that this is an investment that makes sense for the community and is needed by the community. I will stop at that point and ask if there are questions that you have or if there's more information that we can provide.
Committee members? Okay, Mr. Letellier, do you have anything further?
No, sir. I'm Gary Letellier, the Executive Director of the Coos County Airport District, and I'm just here to answer any questions you might have of a technical nature.
You'd probably prefer to hear a due pass.
Okay. That would be fine. Okay.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Sorry to. No, you both yesterday.
What the?
You've been through all right.
Is this? We have more people here. Okay, look here. Because I got to run to my office while we can vote.
Yeah. Just a couple of comments before I take a motion. There was an individual one time that told me that you had to learn the legislative process, respect the legislative process, and learn to work with the legislative process to be successful. And I was going around my office, jumping up and down my first 2 weeks I was here. They said nobody would run a business like they run this building. I was totally frustrated. And that was Senator Mesner. I want to thank him for that advice because I think I've been able to use that. Sometime back, I can't remember, it was long before I came here, I read a quote, and it was, "Diplomacy is the art of letting the other person have your way." I use that frequently here. You have to think about it a little bit. I want to thank all those that testified today in favor of Senate Bill 152, especially those that had to travel, and the legislators who have come together on this project in a total bipartisan way now. It's also always the desire of a legislator to have their priority bill assigned to the committee that they chair. And I wasn't sure how I could justify having 152 assigned to the Judiciary Committee. It would have been quite a stretch to get it there. And the events unfolded that brought Senate Bill 152 to the House State and Federal Affairs Committee and afforded me this opportunity by Speaker Minutes. We didn't know how it was going to fall together, but it has worked, and it's worked for the benefit of our people. I again want to thank Speaker Minutes, Representative Scott, Morgan, and Cruz for going to the North Bend Airport last Friday and viewing the airport project and recognizing the importance of it to the people of the South Coast and now who have come together to support the project. So, any further comments by anybody, please?
Just very briefly, I'm going to be really pleased to be able to support this bill today. And there was talk about the other Oregon, and there seems to be quite a division in the building, talking about rural and urban Oregon. And I think that divide, at least in my mind, is going away. We see more legislators elected in the last session and this session from the suburban areas who want to see Oregon move forward and not just their district. And I know I spent time up in Central Oregon looking at the Redmond Airport where they need some expansion capability as well. And I'm from the evil Willamette Valley. And I know anything north of Salem and west of the mountain seems to be thought of as one vote, one thought, and that's not true anymore. And I'm looking forward to helping move Oregon, all of Oregon, forward.
Thank you. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is obviously a great project. I'm delighted to see it go forward. If you'll just indulge me for a moment, we have another set of transportation projects and another bill that we moved but has not not been moved through the process yet, the Connect Oregon package, which really benefits the whole state in various ways. And I want to make sure we don't lose sight of that. And having seen the energy that people put into breaking a little political logjam that had arisen in front of this project, gives me hope that the political logjam, if there is one forming around that larger and I think even more important package, can be broken as well. I think that our work will not be done in this session until we get that set of projects going.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 152A to the Budget Committee with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 152A to the Budget Committee with a due pass. Any further discussion? Objections? Call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Help me think on it a while. Aye. Senate Bill 152A moves to the floor, or to the Budget Committee with a due pass. And we will close the work session on 152A. Thank you very much for coming. We're going to drop down so you know what the order of business is going to be. We're going to go down to 1085, back up to 1016, and then back to 1072. That'll be the order that will take the bills today. Going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1085A. Public hearing and work session. Okay.
Representative Steve Walsh is here. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1085 is the bill that modifies the amount of medical marijuana for authorized persons or designated primary caregivers that may possess medical marijuana under certain circumstances. It clarifies the meaning of a mature plant for the purposes of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. It sets forth other requirements. It also requires the Department of Human Services to develop a system to allow authorized law enforcement personnel to access a list of persons issued the registry identification cards. There are other aspects to the bill that I'm sure the proponents and supporters of the bill will speak to. I want to bring to your attention you have the A3 amendments and the A4 amendments behind your staff major summary. Mr. Chair, did you want me to review those now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the A3s allow a third party to grow marijuana for a cardholder who has been convicted of violating ORS 475.992, which is the Schedule 1 controlled substance Class A or B felony. So if they're convicted and found guilty of a Class A or B felony of having possession of a controlled substance, this amendment pertains to that. It also allows the cardholder or the designated primary caregiver of the cardholder who has been convicted of above-mentioned violation to possess 1 ounce of usable marijuana at any given time for a period of 5 years from the conviction date. The A4 amendments may sound familiar to the committee. They provide that employers are not required to accommodate for the use of medical marijuana regardless if it is used at the workplace. It provides that employers are not required to either allow an employee or an independent contractor to possess, consume, or be impaired by the use of marijuana during working hours, or allow any person who is impaired by the use of marijuana to remain in the workplace. It provides that nothing in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act will preclude an employer from establishing or enforcing a policy to achieve or maintain a drug-free workforce.
Okay. I want to have Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz, and Representative March. Can you come up, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. I'll be very brief. The Supreme Court will be hearing a case similar to what you're proposing in the A4 amendments. The case is on appeal. The case was brought as a challenge to the use of medical marijuana in the workplace. The basis of the challenge was that medical marijuana is a legal medication and it should be treated as other legal medications. If the Supreme Court does find in favor of the proponents or the people who brought the case, then the order of the court, I understand, would be to accommodate, to find an accommodation for the people who have legitimate use of that medication. Now, I guess I am going to say that if the A4s do pass, I don't see any way that there can be a concurrence on the Senate side, and so basically the bill is dead for this session. I would suggest that you do the A4s in a separate bill. We spent too much time, and you'll hear from law enforcement, working on a compromise. That precludes a compromise, the A4s, at this point. So, as the chair of the committee, I will make that decision. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. Actually,
didn't that come out of rules?
Anyway, that's a side issue, Mr. Chair. I'm here to support the bill and the A3 amendments. The A3 amendment was, as we worked through this in the Senate, we realized we needed one more technical fix. That is the A3 amendment, and we agreed in committee and on the record and on the floor that the A3s would follow the bill over to the House, and we would request that amendment there. So for the record, I strongly encourage the A3s. It's not a sea change, but it's a technical fix that needs to be done to the bill. I see a lot of merit to the A4s. However, I just want to say we have been working on this issue for 4 years, and it has been a long, hard road for us to get to the point we were now. I was chief sponsor of the medical marijuana bill last session when I was in the House, and at the end of the day, we just could not quite get to where we needed to go. There were work groups formed during the session. The work groups tended to splinter, but information was brought forward. We have been working with the advocates, with the patients, with Department of Human Services, and with law enforcement, and with DAs on this thing for months. And what is really needed right now, there were some folks who said after the Supreme Court decision, should we even be doing this? And the answer is, I think the need for us to do it is even more apparent because of the Supreme Court decision. And because we don't want Oregon to necessarily become a target. And with this, I don't think they will. But the thing that was, whether you support the concept of medical marijuana or not is irrelevant. It was an initiative passed by the people. That's the end of that discussion from my perspective. I'm a elected state official, and it my job is to make what the people want workable. We had our first bite of that apple in 97 when we created the program and put some parameters around it. It was rough. We knew it was full of holes. We knew it was going to need modification. This bill is not perfect, I'm sure of that. But this bill goes a long way towards what everybody in the system has said they really wanted, and that is some clear, bright lines between what's allowed and what's not. Who can do what and who can't. This bill, I think, takes us 95% of the way there. Politics can be played with lots of things in this building. As I say, I support in concept the A4 amendments to this. I don't think that's a finished product either. Mr. Chair, my main concern at this point in time is that we lose the main bill due to politics, and we leave everybody in the no man's land they have now. 1085 is the bill. It's had many forms, many numbers, but that's the bill we have now. Colleagues, 1085 is something that is needed. It is needed now. I don't think, from the perspective of DAs, law enforcement, and patients, that we can keep them in this very fuzzy no man's land for another 2 years when we have an opportunity to clearly define issues now. So, like I said, the A4s have merit. I would hate to lose 1080, and the A3s need to be included, but I would hate to lose 1085 this session. I think it's too important for us not to pass the bill and answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve March. I represent House District 46 in the center of Portland. This is an issue that we've been working on for a number of years. The current law has a lot of vagueness to it. And obviously, from the perspective of law enforcement, from the perspective of the district attorneys, and from the perspective of the medical marijuana cardholders, the law needs clarification. This 1085 in its current form with the dash A3s would provide clear lines for law enforcement, for the district attorneys, and for the patients and caregivers themselves. It would be very distinct in the law. The other issue addressed by the A4s is before the Supreme Court, and they will determine which direction we should go in that. I think the A4s are premature. I think the Supreme Court needs to make that decision. I don't think they're going to make a decision that's going to wind up negatively affecting business. I think it'll be a rational decision. The A3s are something with 1085 we need now. And I'd be happy to take any questions, and I'm just here to show support.
Okay. Committee members, do you have any questions of the representatives and senators?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like the real focal point here is on the A4 amendments, which were the substance of which was in another bill that the House passed out. For Representative March, I wanted to just probe that last comment you made. It strikes me that what we have here is a collision between two public policies. We have the desire for people who are suffering from certain pain conditions that need management and who find medical marijuana helpful. And then on the other one, we have a public policy that allows employers to have a drug-free workplace. And it's the collision between those two policies. And it seems to me that the legislature, as the policy-making body, ought to be making the decision here, that it's really for the legislature to decide which of those policies prevails in workplace testing of the people that find people have drugs in their system. So any response to that?
Yes. Several medications can impair one's ability in the workplace, and there's nothing to prohibit rational employer policies that if someone's performance is inhibited, that the job they're performing, they might need, inhibits that performance, they might need to be shifted to a different place in the workplace. If you're not able to work with heavy equipment, for example, because of some cold medications even that might or a pain medication that might be prescribed for your doctor, the employer is expected to make reasonable accommodations for that medication in terms of, well, maybe you don't drive the equipment today when you're on that medication. And I don't see anything in the Medical Marijuana Act that would prohibit reasonable accommodations And I expect the Supreme Court to find the same finding, that any drug prescribed by a doctor, which medical marijuana has to be, can be accommodated in a workplace to a reasonable extent.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Well, my reading of the A4 is, under the bill we have before us, is that it simply avoids requiring an employer to accommodate. It doesn't prevent an employer from accommodating. And I think that's sort of the nub of the issue to me, is that an employer can choose to accommodate, and I would urge anybody who has a medical marijuana card to approach their employer and indicate, I'm going to test positive because I'm using this substance. And I think in we heard testimony on the other bill that employers are accommodating. It's just a question of whether they're required to accommodate as opposed to whether they are permitted to accommodate, which I think that this would not affect.
Well, the reasonable accommodation under a variety of laws, not only state, but federal, ADA laws, et cetera, I think come into play, and I think that's that fine distinction. Are you saying that one particular medication should be different than all other medications, and that's what you're saying with the A4s? This one medication, out of all of the myriad of medications out there, is different enough that we should treat it differently, and I think that particular decision is not a decision that we should be looking at here. I think it's a decision that the courts should look at in the broader context of all of the requirements to make reasonable accommodations, and in consideration of case law, and in consideration of all of the medical facts before them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I could... thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. There is a difference here, and part of the difference is what is looked for in a drug screen, and not all medications are looked for. I mean, you can do a drug screen and find anything you're looking for, but if you're not looking for it, you don't find it. Marijuana is one of the standard drugs looked for in a drug screen. So to a degree, this is slightly different, and like I said in my earlier testimony, the intent of the A4s, I think, are valid, incredibly valid, and I think that sort of flexibility and protection is probably needed. And I would love to continue that debate, but Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, my fear is losing the main bill because of it, and I just want to make sure that we don't lose something good because we're trying to do something else good, that at this point in time, based on testimony before the Senate Rules Committee, it did not appear that the feeling was the same in the Senate for all people. Now, if we had a certainty that adopting the A4s, we could get the votes for concurrence in the Senate, that's one thing. If it dies because of a caucus position in the Senate on concurrence, then I think we've lost more than we potentially gain.
On the workplace issue, back a few years ago when I had a job, in several workplaces I know, if there was an accident, somebody runs a forklift into the freight line or whatever, they drug screen them. Or they, and anything at all, alcohol, even legal drugs such as alcohol, you're fired. I mean, or sent to treatment, whatever, if you happen to have protections of a labor contract. So what happens now? I mean, what will this change in that? If somebody tests positive for marijuana, you can say, well, they're not really impaired, and we've heard testimony, at least in the other bill, that you really can't tell it because it stays in the system. They may not be impaired, but it'll show up.
Right.
So somebody drives the forklift through the big door, and they test positive for marijuana, and they want to fire them. What effect will this have without the dash four? Or with either way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, as I just stated, this is a real issue, and when marijuana became a legal medical substance, the discussion certainly changed. Before the act, it was a clear, bright line. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not sure what the solution is. I'm not sure that the A4s are absolutely correctly defined. And be quite honest, from my perspective, if that House bill came to the floor of the Senate, I would vote for it. But with the political dynamics we have in the Senate, I'm not sure what the reaction would be. And my whole point, Representative, is I don't want to lose the main bill because of that.
Thank you. Any members, any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Senator?
Thank you. One of the recommendations I would make, which may be would be to go the administrative rule route. Now, I'm aware that there is a Supreme Court ruling on this. I think that this is an issue that could be discussed and administrative rules could be drafted to deal with some of the very difficult situations that may arise. If we had had the discussion of this bill early on and had been able to sit down and talk with law enforcement and with all of the stakeholders, there are a number of different positions held by patients of medical marijuana. Some people would be very happy if this bill went away. There's a group of patients who hate this bill because it is tighter than the existing law. We tried to accommodate the patients along with law enforcement, realizing that the difficulties in the law work both ways. They work against the patient as well. We have to accommodate both groups. We spent a lot of time, countless hours doing this. During the interim, we had a work session that kind of came apart at the seams. We had Dr. Higginson, who is our chief medical officer, worked with that group, drafted the original bill that we now have. We tore it apart, put it back together, and thought we had a pretty good product. Not perfect, but good. In fact, I think the perfect is the enemy of the good. If you wait for perfection, we're never going to do anything. So I just recommend strongly that we pass the A3s, leave the A4s for further consideration. If the court makes a decision, fine. If they don't make a decision, we can do that in administrative rules. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Erin Hildebrandt, is she here? And I'd like to have Leland, is it Berger? Is there a Leland Berger? Okay, I'd like to have the two of you testify together, please.
Would you like to go first? Good morning. Thank you, Chair Barker. My name is Leland Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R. I'm a lawyer. My bar number is 83020. I have a statewide practice representing medical marijuana patients and caregivers, and I also represent other people in other criminal matters at the trial level, and I also do appellate and post-conviction work. So I'm often on the other side of Ms. Suver, who's present from the Marion County District Attorney's Office, and Mr. Sylvester, who's present from the Attorney General's Office. Although I've worked with Mr. Sylvester on, I know he's working on an Attorney General guidelines for implementation of law. I hoped that I could actually begin by responding to some of Representative McPherson's questions, and I wanted to say also that I especially appreciate your service, and I read that you're one of only two lawyers in the House currently, and I appreciate that perspective. The case that Senator Morissette was referring to is Washburn versus Roseburg Forest Products. Phil Labenbaum is the lawyer for the for Washburn, and it's an area of the law that's different from the area of the law that I work with, but I did want to touch on your question about why the judiciary or the legislature, which branch is appropriate to resolve this, and Senator Morissette suggested the third branch, actually, that the executive promulgate administrative rules. The reason why it's appropriate that the judiciary decide this issue is because it has to do with discrimination. And what this bill would do is, as you point out, is not require discrimination, but it would certainly allow it. It would allow an employer to fire a patient simply because the employee is a patient and for no other reason. That's what it means when it says in the dash 4 under 2A, regardless of where the use occurs. The fact is that cannabis metabolites, something that the law enforcement, I think, and I agree on, stay in the system for 3 or 4 weeks. These can be completely unrelated to the productivity or the reason for an accident of the kind that Representative Barker described. And nonetheless, an employer could fire an employee simply because they don't agree that marijuana is medicine, even though the people have found it to be medicine as and made a legislative finding in the Medical Marijuana Act. And I participated in the compromise that was the Dash 3, and I really appreciate both Senator Morissette and Senator Cruz and Representative March's efforts at arriving at compromise legislation. But and I think whether to support or oppose this bill is an especially close call, because I also agree with Senator Morissette that, you know, when you come to the legislature to resolve a problem, it's not fair to expect perfection. If you want a perfect law, you draft an initiative, and that's what we tried to do with Measure 33, which 42% of the voters approved, but that was it. So here we are. There are really good things in Senate Bill 1085. For example, on page 3 at section 2, sub 3, we've been trying to get the, well, it defines a plant as being 12 inches in height or 12 inches in diameter. The section 4 that protects healthcare administrators who are administering medical marijuana on page 5 is a positive thing. The advisory committee that the bill creates is a positive thing. And the 24/7 including a limitation on law enforcement distributing that information is a positive thing. However, most of these things are already happening. There is an administrative advisory committee to the medical marijuana program that meets quarterly already. Dr. Higginson, both in the advisory committee and in the legislative advisory committee that met in between sessions, allowed input from pretty much anybody who showed up. Everybody who showed up felt that they could be heard, and so we're moving in the direction of 24/7 verification by law enforcement about who's a patient, and that'll happen whether you pass 1085 out or not. We're moving in the direction of defining a plant, and I think that'll happen whether you pass 1085 out or not. And so the problem I have with the bill is that the things that are positive in the bill are minor, and the things that are negative, for me, outweigh the positive. And chief among those first and foremost among those is the repeal of the affirmative defense. The affirmative defense for cardholders in ORS 475306 is repealed in Section 2 of the bill. And the affirmative defense for non-cardholders, although it's retained, the portion of the bill... The portion of the bill that put that back in deleted, I'm looking now at Section 12 on page 9, subsection 1C, or amends subsection 1C, to allow a patient to establish by preponderance of the evidence that a greater amount is medically necessary. So the problem is that while I can share with the committee that the reason why the Legislative Advisory Committee was unable to reach a compromise is because law enforcement insisted on the repeal of the affirmative defense and the patients opposed it. I took the position in the interim after the committee ended and before the session began that there were conditions under which the affirmative defenses could be repealed. But they have to be quantities that are high enough to allow that to happen. Here, at the last minute in the Senate, and apparently at the request of law enforcement, the limits were reduced. So instead of 7 plants, which de facto is how it is everywhere, the law is 3 mature and 4 immature, but most counties, I mean, not in Josephine, not in a couple of others, but most counties allow 7 plants, is suddenly reduced to 6 plants. And although the number of ounces is increased to 24 ounces to reflect that patients aren't cultivating and picking, but are instead cultivating and harvesting, the fact is that although the law, if 1085 passes, will make many patients legal who are currently illegal, the problem is that it'll still leave a great many patients behind. And when I have a statewide practice doing this work. I've been I've appeared in court in Coquille. I've driven to Coos Bay. I've flown in and out of North Bend. I was glad to hear this morning about the passage of that bill, frankly. I hope it's not presumptuous of me to say so. But people in Coos County, people in Douglas County, people in Josephine County, people in Jackson County cultivate principally outdoors, and they cultivate once a year. And if they cultivate once a year and they have only 24 ounces that they're allowed to have, they're not going to have enough medicine to make it through the year. That's what's going to happen. The federal government has an investigational new drug protocol, and they deliver marijuana that's farmed at the University of Mississippi to 6 remaining patients. There were 7 remaining patients. There were 11, and 5 died, and have for the last 25 years. And the least amount that any of these patients get is 6 pounds a year. So, and I had testified before the Senate committee, and I know that Sandy Burbank for Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse, who's here, has brought copies with her of really the only text that I'm aware of on the yield of marijuana, or cannabis as it's more properly called, cannabis yields, authored by Chris Conrad in El Cerrito, California. And, if we look to California, the limits there are more reasonable in terms of what the reality is. So, the increasing the limits makes sense, and I think, frankly, that repealing the affirmative defense makes sense for law enforcement and for patients, too, but not with these limits, not with the limitations that are here. So that's principally my objection to 1085. The second problem with 1085 is currently drafted. Oh, I wanted to mention, too, on the -4 amendments, Phil Labenbaum was the lawyer on that. I did, because we're all talking to each other electronically, have an opportunity to review Dr. Baer's testimony at the hearing on 2693, which is where the -4s come from, I think. And I'd refer the committee to that testimony. He outlines pretty clearly how the studies show also pretty definitively that after 3 or 4 hours after use, that overwhelmingly people who use cannabis, whether they use it recreationally or use it spiritually or use it medicinally, no longer feel the effects of it. So I wanted to say that. The second problem is on page 7 in section 7, subsection 7. The current law is that there can't be any deliveries for consideration. As a practical matter, since Stormy Ray, with Dr. Baer, the other co-chief petitioner of the 1998 Medical Marijuana Act, held a series of roundtables in 1999 and 2000, de facto, the law has been that patients can compensate caregivers so long as they're not paying for the labor. But supplies and the costs of production, other than the costs of the labor in producing everywhere, are like that. And I know, and we had asked at the Legislative Advisory Committee to codify that, and Scott Heiser, who was there on behalf of, he's the district attorney in Benton County and Corvallis, who's the, I think, still currently the head of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, opposed it. But, and I know from speaking with Lieutenant Durbin from the state police that this is viewed as, an incremental step forward, adding costs of supplies and utilities. But I want the committee to know that it's actually, in fact, a step backwards, and it will ultimately result in the restriction of medical marijuana. It'll mean that more patients have to do without, and that's why that section is a deal breaker for me. The next problem is on page 8, in section 9, subsection 1C. This takes a little explaining. Currently, anybody who has a debilitating medical condition, who has written documentation from their attending physician indicated they've been diagnosed with a debilitating medical condition, and in the opinion of their attending physician, marijuana might mitigate the symptoms or effects of the condition, register with the Department of Human Services, or issued a registry identification card, which entitles them to either cultivate or designate someone to cultivate for them. And currently, there's no limit on the number of patients a caregiver can cultivate for. In Measure 33, we sought to limit that to 10 and then created this third category called dispensaries, where you need 25 signatures and so forth. What 1085 does as a compromise is it creates a new category called a person responsible for a grow site. But it limits the production in the section that I recited, Section 9, sub 1C, it limits the production of marijuana to up to 4 registry identification cardholders or designated primary caregivers per year at the grow site. And that is a deal breaker as well, because it's not the way that it's working now. There aren't enough qualified people who know. I don't grow marijuana, and I've never grown marijuana, but I've seen a lot of gardens. I've seen spindly gardens, I've seen big bushy trees, and I've represented and have known patients and have known activists and caregivers who've cultivated for multiple patients. There, I know, for example, there's a caregiver who cultivates for 6 or 8 patients who are in hospice care currently. If this bill passes, he's not going to be able to continue to do that. And somebody in hospice care who's dying isn't going to be able to get their medical marijuana. That's what's going to happen. So that's why that section is a deal breaker. And the last one is it's kind of a legal problem, is I'm looking now at 475.319 sub 3, and I did participate in drafting the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act as well as Measure 33, and when we drafted the act, we created really 3 levels of protection, and the first level is the card that exempts or accepts people from the criminal law and exempts them from arrest, prosecution, and forfeiture. And the next level is you could be arrested, but you'd have an affirmative defense. The third level is everybody else would have a choice of evils defense. 1999, the legislature law enforcement was unhappy with that provision, and they persuaded the legislature, actually I think in this room, before the House Judiciary Committee, Sandy Burbank and I were here, to amend it in the fashion that it's amended here, and it needs to be cleaned up. I mean, it says that no one's prevented from presenting evidence supporting the necessity of marijuana for treatment of a specific disease, but it doesn't specifically say that you're entitled to a medical necessity defense. Brian Michaels from Eugene is a lawyer who also handles these kinds of cases and participated in lobbying and drafting 1085. Has persuaded a judge in Linn County in Albany, I know, that it means that, but that's because he's a good lawyer. I don't know that it's always going to shake out that way. But more significantly, there was a decision from the Court of Appeals a couple of months ago, State versus Miles. And State versus Miles changed the application of the choice of evils defense to medical marijuana patients in a way that functionally denies it to people who are cultivating. Because it says that if they're if you have to wait a while to get your medicine, and if you're cultivating marijuana, you have to wait a while to get your medicine, then there's no emergency for you to, there's no imminent harm for you to choose between the lesser of two evils. Well, that's not true, and that's contrary to the intent of the voters in 1998. The intent of the voters was that, and I guess I can close with this. I mean, the idea is that, not only that patients shouldn't, I mean, before there was an Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, and there's a case that says this, State versus ONB, O-W-E-N-B-Y, there was no choice of evils defense, and patients were who were using marijuana then were arrested. They were taken to jail. They were brought before a judge. They could have a trial, but they couldn't defend on the basis that it was their medicine, on the basis that they didn't have any choice. And the purpose of subsection 3 of 475.319 was to make sure that that didn't happen again. The legislature this session has had an opportunity to correct it, and for whatever reason they haven't. And because of those four problems, and because of the problems with the dash 4, I would encourage the committee to not pass out 1085. I can tell you that when I appeared before rules, because although the bill started as 772 in Senator Morissette and Senator Cruz's Health Services Committee, it was renumbered as 1085 and was in the Rules Committee. You know, again, I think it's a close call whether to support or oppose this. I know that y'all have a budget deal. I know that things are going to shut down quick, and I'm sorry that there isn't enough time to fix it this session, but there's not enough time to fix it this session. And for all those reasons, I respectfully request that you not pass this bill out to the floor. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time and patience. I'd be glad to answer any questions if anybody has any questions.
Go ahead and identify yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Erin Hildebrandt, and I have an organization called Parents Ending Prohibition. Obviously, I'm one of those legalizers, but I'm also a medical marijuana patient, and my husband is my caregiver, and so we're both cardholders with the OMMP. For me, the illness that I have been treating primarily is Crohn's disease, which affects me pretty severely, and trying to care for five kids at home, let alone here, is pretty challenging, especially when I'm in the bathroom all the time and I'm throwing up. You know, if your kid comes and asks you for a hug and you're throwing up, that's really the last thing that you want to be doing. But I come at this from a broader perspective, too, because I've grown up listening to stories of my grandma and how she grew up during alcohol prohibition. She lived in Detroit, and her family lived right upstairs in an apartment from the notorious Purple Gang's headquarters, which gave her kind of a unique perspective on this. And she always tells the story about how my great-grandfather got this prized bottle of booze from his friends downstairs and had it in a secret closet in the house. And there's a long family history here. We don't know exactly what happened, but apparently one day my great-grandmother decided to pour that down the sink because she was so afraid that the police were going to come in and arrest them for having it. And this was told to me in kind of a funny way. This is sort of a joke, and that's what I keep seeing whenever marijuana comes up, except pretty much here when law enforcement is discussing it. We have this big joke. We have a former president who swears he didn't inhale. I don't know, maybe he ate a brownie. We have a current president who has used marijuana and possibly other drugs. I don't know. And it becomes this joke on sitcoms, and how many comedians have gotten rich off of "I didn't inhale." But then law enforcement starts talking about it, and it's as though it's this scourge on society, something we should all be afraid of. This little plant, I picture a plant holding up its leaves like this saying, "Don't shoot." Marijuana here isn't the problem, and we're trying to put Band-Aids and Bactine on a festering gangrenous wound if this is how we're trying to solve the problems of drug abuse in our society. I don't feel like if this bill goes through and 2693 passes and 3457 passes, I do not feel that my kids are going to be any safer next year because of this. We're not addressing the real problem. We're not addressing the problem that people like my grandmother's mother addressed when they came out against alcohol prohibition because of the hypocrisy, the corruption, the loss of life, the animosity between the citizen and government, and the devastating effect it had upon the youth of the nation. We created organized crime with alcohol prohibition, and we've sustained it with our current prohibitions. I have lost tremendous respect for law enforcement because of being a medical marijuana patient. I grew up, and these guys were my heroes. These were the people you call when you're in trouble. You call the police. And I have lived many, many years terrified of the police and thinking, if I'm in trouble, I can't call them because I have this illegal medicine here. I lived in Maryland where we didn't have these options. And I was terrified. I kept imagining that someone would break into my house, a police officer, and point guns at my kids. And what are the chances five little kids aren't going to move just because someone points a gun and says freeze? They'd be scared to death. So this, to me, is little tiny half measures that are going to hurt patients in this state. And I ask that you please, please let this bill die in committee. I agree with pretty much everything that Sandy Burbank is going to say, so I'll leave the details up to the rest of you. But please, be my heroes today. Stand up and decide that we're not going to continue throwing money at a failed approach. Try a new approach. There are better ways. Thank you.
Committee members, have any questions? Okay, thank you. Could I have David Fedanke and Sandy Burbank come up, please? Do you know if Dave left the room for just a few minutes, or did he have to leave?
Well, no, I'll check the hall bill.
Okay. Sandy, you can go ahead if you'd like.
Okay. Would you like these books ahead of time? You might.
Is Jim Craig here? Why don't you come up, too, if you can move the chair for him. We'll get the three of you.
My name is Sandy Burbank. I'm director of Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse. We've existed since 1982 to address the issues of substance use, misuse, and abuse, and to teach people how to avoid problems with all drugs. In 1991, after meeting some of the federal legal patients that Leland Berger referred to, we discovered and decided that marijuana truly was medicine. After watching these people use their medication and watching a tremendous difference in the way they felt, talking with Aldi Musica, who had found that marijuana was the only thing that was saving her eyesight from glaucoma. And these people are discussed in this book here. The IND program, which is the Investigative New Drug Program, has been run by the federal government for many years now. And there's information in this book that I have here about those people. But it is because of those people and the doses that they have that I have felt compelled to come forward and speak to you today. I was the director of the first medical marijuana initiative in 1996. We didn't have much funding, and the initiative in 98 is the one that passed. I worked on the wording of that initiative from the beginning. I worked all the way through it, and all the processes since. I've been on the administrative work group since its inception, and in fact was the one that caused that to happen, was on the legislative advisory committee where all of us worked very, very hard, including the various advocacy groups, because we did not agree on all of the issues, and we tried to come up with issues we agreed on. Unfortunately, when we refused to give up the affirmative defense for any variety of reasons, even a definition of a plant, law enforcement walked out of that meeting, and this bill is a result of the things that we had all worked on together at that time. I, through MAMA now, since February, run a medical marijuana clinic. And in my experience, I have helped over 1,000 patients get registered for the medical marijuana program. I wish you could meet the patients that I meet and the seriousness of their illnesses. I wish you could hear them tell me about the difficulty that they have getting medicine. I wish you could talk to the people from hospice who call me who have a patient who's dying. Maybe they have 2 weeks left, and they find relief in marijuana because they can cut back on the amount of morphine they're using, which allows them to be lucid up until the time they die. There are a lot of problems out there with the medical marijuana bill the way it exists. However, there's good things about it, too, and as Leland Berger has said, many of the things that are in this bill that seem to be so positive are things that are already happening through the administrative process, the 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week verification, which will benefit both law enforcement and the patients. We're already working on that, and Lee has already said all of those things. I won't repeat them. I really want to thank everybody who's worked so hard all these hours to come together on this, but as Senator Cruz said, we've only come 95% of the way. And that other 5% is really important, because that 5% is the part that we need to finish before we pass this bill out. While the current law is far from perfect and has unrealistic limits set for the amounts patient can possess, it does have the affirmative defense for the OMMP cardholders. This allows a patient who might temporarily possess over the allowed amounts to prove that the overage was not intended for any criminal use, but was only to be used by legal patients. A patient should not be a criminal if the only issue is the amount of medicine they have for their own use. If the medicine is being diverted into the black market or given to non-patients, then there is a crime, and law enforcement would have the same burden of proof that they have with all the other crimes out there to show that a crime has been committed. I brought two copies of this book, Cannabis Yields and Dosages, which is written by Chris Conrad, a court-qualified cannabis expert, that explains the amount that a patient can have and what can be expected as a yield from a garden. In here, on page one, they have a listing of four of the legal patients and how long they've been using cannabis, how much they normally use, and that amount is way above the 24 ounces that is allowed in this bill. Now, 24 ounces might seem like a lot, but I can tell you that many patients use an ounce or more a week. So for those people who have to grow outside, partly because of finances or because that is truly the best way, they would need 52 ounces for a year. So automatically, if that person tried to have the amount of medicine that they needed for the year, nobody else, just for themselves, they would be out of compliance with this law and would become a very serious criminal. That shouldn't happen. That is totally wrong. This book also talks about the definitions of the plants and the yields that can be expected. Again, I am a caregiver. I am a patient. I caregive. My husband and I caregive for 10 patients right now. Rarely do we have the full number of plants that we need. And not only do we take care of those 10 patients for the full amount of cannabis that they need, but we also are called upon to help hospice, and law enforcement sends people to us in the fall for yields. This is absolutely the truth. I live in Wasco County. Call the sheriff's office and ask them. This book right here is very good, and I encourage you to take a chance just to look at the first few pages, which will outline what a patient really needs in a year, and that's what I'm concerned about. Senate Bill 1085 is also unclear to me in regard to how many patients for whom a caregive can grow. I fear that limiting the number of patients and disallowing for some real costs of production, which includes security issues, and that's not included in this. Security is a really big deal when you've got the black market out there that would make medical marijuana worth the price of gold. And if you think about having all that gold sitting in your backyard and how many people might be trying to get in to get it, then security becomes very serious and sometimes very costly, and that price should not be borne by the person who is raising it for the patient at no cost, with no labor reimbursement. That cost, in my opinion, should be borne by the patient if they can. I fear that limiting the number of patients and disallowing those real costs, not including labor costs, now I'm not talking about labor costs, will leave even more patients without medicine. There's already a lack of caregivers who are willing to perform this unpaid labor of compensation, of compassion and love, because that's the only reason you're doing it. There is no other reason. You're getting no money for all that time you put in and all the hassle of dealing with the patients. I urge you to shelve this bill until there's an opportunity to address these glaring problems. I believe that a bill can be produced that will realistically meet the needs of the patients, yet make clear for law enforcement when a real crime is being committed. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify, and I take any questions if you have them.
Thank you. I don't want to be repetitive, but one thing that this cannabis yields and dosage does also is it levels the playing field
between indoor and outdoor growers.
Can you state your name, please?
I'm sorry. My name is James Gregg. I reside in Eugene, and I'm a medical marijuana patient.
Thank you.
Anyway, just to continue, that it does level the playing field for both the indoor and outdoor growers and give them an equal opportunity to produce enough medicine for themselves. Anyway, I have been a medical marijuana patient for several years now, and I have a primary condition of severe arthritis and secondary conditions associated with chronic pain, muscle spasms, anorexia, and glaucoma. And in my opinion, in its current form, Senate Bill 1085 does more harm than good. First of all, there already exists a disproportionate number of patients to designated growers. Please pointed that out. I don't want to, you know, be redundant to go over it again, but by eliminating the number of patients anyone a grower can provide for, makes the ratio a lot worse. There's a lot of patients that are constantly looking for growers to provide medicine for them, and especially in the veterans community. Also, and probably even more importantly, would be the affirmative defense for OMA. And I know a lot of fellow patients whose medical condition is a lot worse than mine. In fact, I feel rather healthy when I go to the hospital. And because of their individual conditions, they may need to use a lot more medicine than others. And I really find it hard to believe that law enforcement officials know more than a patient's doctor does about the patient's individual condition, how much and how they ingest their cannabis. You know, as it's been pointed out, many of them can't smoke or won't and need to eat it or use it topically. And that just increases the amount of medicine they need annually. And finally, in my opinion, 1085 comes a long way from completing the circle. True patient reform can only come when patients have safe access to their medicine. And given the counties with the greatest number of OMA patients reside are in urban in nature, for instance, Portland and Eugene, and the difficulty in growing medical-grade cannabis, I don't believe there will ever be enough caregivers providing free medicine for all patients. I live in a real world, and without dispensary, there will always be patients who have to go to the black market or streets to get their medicine. And this is especially new for brand-new patients or first-time patients. For instance, a veteran who contracts hepatitis C or any other senior citizen that really has had no experience with this type of activity and has nowhere to go for his medicine. And what I can understand is that law enforcement officials can't seem to grasp are the old laws of supply and demand. And as long as there are thousands of patients in need of medicine, patients are perpetuating the very problem that law enforcement fears. If left to ourselves, all OMA patients, there would be 10,000 less potential black market customers in this state. When you take the profit out of the equation, less people break the law. And again, just look back to the 20s to see if the end of probation did for bootlegging. While I agree patient reform is desperately needed, I don't believe this bill is the bill to reform any of these issues discussed, and I respectfully request you to vote no on Senate Bill 1085 in its current form. Okay. And I would love any questions on the American Disabilities Act.
David?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. And I very briefly just wanted to address the -84 amendments, Mr. Chair, and make it clear that we oppose those amendments. I think you're familiar with the reasons for that from the debate on the prior bill that was approved by the House. We believe it's premature to pass a legislative fix for the Court of Appeals decision. That case, as I understand it, a petition for review is currently pending before the Oregon Supreme Court. We do not know yet whether the court is going to take that case. Even if the court does not, the posture of that case was that it had been dismissed at the trial court level. The Court of Appeals said that it shouldn't have been dismissed, that the employer should be required to consider whether a reasonable accommodation could be made for that employee in that particular workplace. When the reasonable accommodation standard is applied, we believe that issues such as the type of the job, whether it involves, whether it's a job that affects public health or safety or the safety of other employees, like the operation of heavy equipment, whether there are alternative ways for the employer to check to see if an employee is under the influence of marijuana when they're on the job, as opposed to having ingested marijuana hours, days, or weeks prior to arriving in the workplace. We believe those considerations will be fairly easy for employers to deal with if, in fact, the Court of Appeals decision is upheld. And for those reasons, we oppose the Dash Ed 4 amendments. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Committee members, do you have any comments or questions of the panel? Thank you very much. Have Greg Turman and Katie, is it Server? Come up, please. I'll have them just come together. That's fine. Together.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Krieger and members of the committee, my name is Katie Suver. I'm with the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm also a Marion County Deputy District Attorney. My primary caseload is the prosecution of narcotics offenses in Marion County. We have appeared several times previously and testified in support of what is now Senate Bill 1085. And obviously, I would echo Senator Cruz's earlier remarks that we have worked very hard to accomplish what we consider to be a compromise, the ultimate goal being to create bright-line rules for law enforcement. To speak from personal experience, what I can tell you is that as a deputy district attorney, I get telephone calls on sometimes a daily or weekly basis where law enforcement officers are attempting to comply with the medical marijuana statute. And the most difficult thing that they have to deal with is when they go into a place where there is a medical marijuana grow and the people have more than the allotted 7 plants that they are allowed under the law. What we attempted to do in helping to draft this particular bill was create a specific number of plants and a specific amount of marijuana that a person was allowed to have. Mr. Berger expressed concern that the affirmative defense was eliminated. I tend to disagree with that. A section of the affirmative defense has been eliminated, and it is that section which created significant ambiguity for law enforcement officers and even for myself. Obviously, we can litigate these issues in court, but it makes it a lot easier from an investigative standpoint to determine what the specific amount of plants and marijuana is, so that law enforcement knows when they can seize lawfully marijuana that is in excess of these amounts specified in the bill and when they can't. The affirmative defense still exists if a defendant can prove by a preponderance of the evidence that they suffered from a debilitating medical condition and that they were growing or in possession of amounts allowed in the bill. The concern about one of the people who previously testified was commenting about the number of ounces or the amount of ounces that a person could have. The bill as it is written now would allow an individual to possess up to 24 ounces of marijuana. That's at any given time. And it allows a person to possess up to 6 mature plants and then, of course, the immature or seedling plants that they can possess in addition to that. Remember that we took out of the bill, although in previous drafts it was in there, that this allowed for only 1 grow cycle in the year. This does not limit the number of grow cycles. And Lieutenant Durbin knows a little bit more from law enforcement perspective and his own training how many grow cycles can be predicted in any given year. But suffice to say, the Stormy Ray Foundation consistently has agreed that these amounts are appropriate, and I know that she is someone who has advocated for a significant period of time for the medical use of marijuana. Regarding the A4 amendments and the A3 amendments, the Oregon District Attorneys Association does not have any concern or issue with those amendments, except to again say that if those amendments were added into the bill, and particularly the A4 amendments, and that resulted in the bill itself not being passed, that would be very unfortunate, because we have worked throughout this entire legislative session to attempt to gain, again, some form of clear, bright lines so that law enforcement can continue to do their job and I, as a prosecutor, can continue to advise them on what the law is. And it makes it a lot easier for me to do my job when you give us specific directives as to what we're supposed to tell law enforcement officers. So I do urge you to pass 1085 And keep in mind, of course, that if these amendments would affect its passage, just to please keep that in mind. Thank you.
Craig.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin. I'm a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police and currently the commander of the Drug Enforcement Section. And I'm here on behalf also of the Oregon Chiefs of Police Association, the Oregon Sheriff's Association. And we are in support of 1085 and the Dash 3 amendments. I sat on the Legislative Advisory Committee with the medical marijuana program. I also was with their administrative work group. And I was part of that law enforcement group that walked away from the table at the time. And the reason I'd like to clarify, it wasn't just because of the affirmative defense issue. It was because that we seen there was many problems that law enforcement was dealing with. And at the time, we were trying to get clarification on those issues so that we could take and be able to go in and have a very clear understanding of what law enforcement needed to do in certain situations. And that's what we felt we needed to get clarified. And on the other side of the table, many of the advocates felt that there was no room for movement as far as that there was wanting an expansion, but really no clarification on several of those issues. There was other parts of the advocacy that felt, yes, there needed to make room for a movement. So at that time, we walked away and decided that we would take it up with the legislature. We have been working now with, and you have to understand, there's about three different camps on the advocacy side. And some of them do not, they want expansion of the program, but really do not want any more restrictions. Other ones feel that what you see in 1085 is a very good bill, and in very, the amounts in there will satisfy what they need as far as for their usage and those type of things. So there are three distinct camps that is going on right now, and it's been difficult in working with those and trying to get a consensus on this bill. But we've worked long and hard over the last 6 months with the senators and working on this, and I feel that we have definitely worked to accommodate in trying to get agreement to something that we could support and felt that was going to provide those clear, bright lines that law enforcement needed. And we did need clear, bright lines, because currently what was happening was, I'll just give you one example. We would walk into a grow site, and we could have anywhere from 7 plants on up to 16, 24 plants, and it was dependent upon what the doctor's recommendation was. And then we would call up a district attorney, and a district attorney, depending on what county you were in Oregon, would either say, okay, pull the plants that they're over. Another county might say, pull all the plants, or another county might say, just leave the plants. And law enforcement was in this quandary. What do you do? And that became very difficult because law enforcement started to incur tort claims because of these issues. And we weren't sure if we'd have to get the marijuana back or not. So we feel that the areas that this creates as far as the issue with the affirmative defense, that now it says that whatever this bill or this law allows as far as the 6 plants is what you will have, and doctors cannot recommend anymore. That's the part of the affirmative defense that was eliminated. It's still there for people that experience a debilitating condition in 12 months. The part that says that you need to carry your registration card on you if you're in possession, you're away from your residence, that's included. That was a thing that we needed. The part that says that and this is a very critical piece, and I believe this is why you've heard a lot of testimony against us today, is that if you're in the program and you take and are convicted, if you're a grower or if you're a caregiver, and you're convicted of a manufacturing or a distribution offense, that you then will have your card revoked for 5 years, first offense, and a lifetime, second offense. If you're a patient, you're not going to get your medicine taken from you, but however, what's going to happen is that you will not be allowed to grow. So you will have to find a caregiver or a grower to grow for you. You will not be allowed to possess up to 24 ounces. You will have 1 ounce at a time. Now, there's two of those camps that said, that's a good thing. We want our program cleaned up. Another one, they were not comfortable with that, and they really did not want revocation of the card at all. But that was something law enforcement felt we really needed to see. And I can give you an example, two different task forces in Oregon, that when they went out, one of them did 18 inspections of grow sites, and 13 of those were out of compliance, and a third of those had methamphetamine involved in them. So, and we have the statistics to back that up. So we needed cleanup of the program. We needed cleanup of the people that were using this program as a guise to just further their activities in controlled substances. And this bill and this law does that. So I hope that we can pass this out, because this will give very clear, bright lines to law enforcement and to the District Attorneys Association of what we need to do in these situations. And on a last note, as far as the medicine issue, I will not have enough marijuana to meet my needs. If you add up, and there was testimony from Mrs. Burbank about that a patient needed 52 ounces per year. If you're a grower, and this is one of the things that we talked about on the administrative work group, on the legislative advisory group, and we talked about with our work with the senators, was that this program really needed a program that trained these people of how to grow marijuana. And if they did that, if they properly trained them, they can get 4 cycles a year of those 6 plants. If you do that and you get the 3 ounces per plant, you're going to get 72 ounces per year with this law, way over that 52 ounces. And also, you can possess 24 ounces at any one time. This law would allow people to share within the program their excess. So there should never be an instance that a person is going to run out of the marijuana that they need. And I think you will hear that in further testimony today. So with that, I would encourage that you to pass this bill out, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Committee members, you have any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We are getting short on time. I'm going to have Jerry Wade come up. If you have something in writing, Mr. Wade, please give that to us. And please summarize as much as you can.
Yes, my name is Jerry Wade, and I'm with the Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation, and I'll try to be as brief as possible.
The one issue I feel that has not been addressed here that this bill does, and the Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation strongly supports this legislation with the -3 amendments and opposes the -4 amendments. The one thing that has not been addressed here, and this has been an issue since the conception of this program, is who owns this medical marijuana that is being grown. There has been a long time debate as far as caregivers claim that because they are growing it at a separate location and they're in control of this medicine, it belongs to them. And that's what it all comes down to, who owns this medicine. One of the key points in this bill is it specifically specifies that all the marijuana, the plants grown, belong are the property of the patient, can be requested at any time. If a patient fires a caregiver, he gets his plants and medicine back. And we asked the Attorney Generals for a clarification on this over a year ago, and they were unwilling to give us a clarification as far as who owns this medication. And if you look at one of the handouts, the story from the Registered Guard I gave you, this is a classic example of one of the problems. It is a group in Roseburg that is charging patients $240 an ounce per month, or not per ounce, but per month. They have taken possession of the garden. If the patient asks to see the garden, complains about the quality of what he's being given, or says that it's not enough, wants to see what's going on, they're immediately fired and canceled from this group. And this is happening too many times in Oregon. Patients are desperate. There is a lack of medicine in this program. And because of this, many patients are willing to agree to almost anything to get medicine. And what happens is a medical marijuana garden can produce 4 or 5 ounces per plant. At the current rate, 3 plants at a time, so that's 12 ounces at a time. The patient is allowed to have 1 ounce away from the garden site, and the caregiver is required to keep all the extra medicine and deal with what's left over. And what's happening is, when these caregivers are growing for 5, 6, 8, 10 people, and they're giving each patient 1 ounce a month, there is an incredible amount of marijuana that is being produced that is not going to the patient. And the question is, where is this medicine going if it's not given to the patient? What 1085 does is it transfers this where the medicine is stored, where the patient has complete control over. The patient can keep all 24 ounces at their location. And if the patient fires the caregivers, they're able to get their property back and their medicine back from these people, because the medicine does not belong to the caregivers. And when they're taking it, they're asking to be able to sell the marijuana.
You can't sell something that does not belong to you. They're asking to transfer the ownership of this medicine from the patient to the caregiver. So they, and what they're trying to set up is co-ops, dispensaries. They're trying to set up ways to have marijuana grown. And you have to ask yourself, there could be no compensation for this marijuana grown, no consideration whatsoever. You can pay for the expenses of the lights and the equipment and the supplies, but there can be no compensation for your label. I have a garden right now which has two patients, me and my roommate's patients, and we spend about an hour a day in that garden working. When you multiply that by four patients, that would be, you know, we're talking about a considerable amount of time that's going to be worked in these gardens for no compensation. Who is going to be doing this? And what is their incentive to do it? And the incentive is they give the patients a token supply of the marijuana being grown, and they keep the rest, and it is being diverted. This bill will give the ownership of this medicine back to the patient and make serious penalties for anybody that is caught diverting medicine in this program, and because the patients cannot afford these gardens barely produce what we need to begin with, and when you have the caregivers stealing 3/4 of it, yes, there is a lack of medicine in our program. But I think this bill will correct many of these problems and make the program not only less abuse and less problems for law enforcement. It clears up and actually gives the ownership back to the patient and stops this. Because patients right now, when this little bill was passed, you had a bunch of sick and disabled people told that if they could find a place to find their medicine or manage to grow it themselves, they could have medical marijuana. Well, at the time, the only people that knew how to grow medical marijuana were the illegal black market. So that's where all of these people turned. And not all. Most caregivers in this program are very honest, caring people that are sincerely helping a disabled person. Don't get me wrong on that. But there are a few people that have learned that patients are very easy targets. If they grow the medicine, they sign up 7 or 8 people, grow the medicine for 4 or 5 months, and at harvest time, they decide not to give it to the patient, there is nothing now that can be done. There is no determination of who owns this medicine. We have contacted law enforcement. Law enforcement says it's a civil matter. You have to take them to court. Most of these people have trouble even affording to grow the medicine, let alone taking somebody to court and suing them to try to recover their property. And this establishes who owns this medicine, and in the event that there is abuse that takes place, there will be a cure now that law enforcement will be able to help these patients. And I strongly support, urge you to pass this with the Dash 3 amendments. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions?
No. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A3 amendment to 1085A.
Representative Boquist has moved the A3 amendments into Senate Bill 1085. Any discussion or objections?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A4 amendments into 1085A.
Representative Boquist has moved the A4 amendments into Senate Bill 1085. Any discussion on the motion? Objections? The A4s are in.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move SB 1085 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1085 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any objections, discussion? Call the roll. Okay.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Excused.
Representative McPherson?
Excused. He's excused.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 1085A as amended moved to the floor with a due pass. And Representative Flores and Barker will be carriers. Close the work session.
You're probably on conference, too.
No. Just in case there was someone here, 995 will be held over until tomorrow. The person who wanted to testify had a medical emergency and couldn't be here. We're going to drop back up to Senate Bill 1016. Do we have, is Senator Morris Anderson been advised that we'll need her?
sure this is Joe.
She was here earlier, but...
And Joe's on the floor, on the Senate floor.
Okay, I think they're on the Senate floor. We'll probably hold that one for just a moment and drop back to Senate Bill 1072. We'll open a public hearing and work session.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1072A establishes a state policy with regard to the utilization of forest biomass. Directs the state forester to take actions to increase the use of forest biomass and report to the governor and legislative assembly every 3 years, beginning no later than October 1st of 2008, on those efforts. It establishes a state policy regarding the relationship between the Department of Forestry and Federal Forest Management and directs the state forester to take actions to increase participation in federal forest management issues. This bill was passed by the Senate on a vote of 29-0. The fiscal impact statement is in the packet that you've been handed out by Sandy. And also in that packet are -A4 amendments, which were received this morning from Representative Burley. And there is a hand-engrossed version of the bill in there that is virtually identical to what the amendments do. There's a few very small changes, but they are not substantive in any way.
Okay, thank you. Senator...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Nelson. I'm a state senator from District 29, which has four counties, Marl, Umatilla, Union, and Wallowa counties. Senate Bill 1072 is basically has a concept called stewardship contracting. And this is a concept that's authorized under federal law by Section 323 of Public Law 108.7. It's good until 2013. It allows Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management to enter into stewardship contracts to achieve land management goals for national forests and public lands that meet local and rural community needs. The issue is Congressman Greg Wallen has this Healthy Forest Practice Act, and there's a short description of it in this letter from Dean Hal Solwasher that says it's a great plan, we just need to get the state involved. And so this bill is a continuation of that objective anyway, to try to get us back and restore the health of our federal forests. So I just got a quick overview thing here of things. Our issue that we have in the West is basically a lot of our lands in the West are owned by the federal government. You can see the comparisons. The dark shaded thing is those are lands that are owned by federal government. In Oregon, I think actually it's about 53 or 54% is owned by the federal government. One out of every acre in the state of Oregon is a federal forest of some manner, shape, or form. And my philosophy is the circle of prosperity broken. This circle of prosperity comes from the Progress Board. We're having a heck of a time right now trying to fund all of our public demands for public education. So I think that this circle of prosperity, I don't think we're doing the right things. I'll have my suggestion later on in this slideshow. Okay. This is forest health. The issue here, just some pictures. This is an article written in the Smithsonian. This is not a right ring, left ring, anything. This is a Smithsonian for back east article saying that we really do need to in our forest, and this is one of the forests. So this picture was actually taken in Arizona. Okay. Federal forest in Oregon in the green just gives you an idea where it is. Cascades is in southern Oregon and along the coast, and some in eastern Oregon. Okay. This is a fire risk. The stuff at the green colored is within the historical okay. I mean, there's probably going to be a fire, but it's all right. The light purple is where there's higher risk, and the deep dark purple is where there is significant risk of forest fires in the state of Oregon. And these are, by and large, federal lands. There's just a thing on tree mortality in Oregon of all ownerships that we're actually losing trees right now. It's a fairly significant amount. This slide shows that the National Forest of the Interior West, the red lines show how much material is actually gathering out there. The blue lines, the little blue boxes, are showing how much we're actually cutting. So it's indicating to you that we're building up this huge amount of forest biomass that has potential to create these terrible fires. Okay, I equate this all to jobs and economy. I think what brought us to the dance here in Oregon is our forest industry, and we've gone away from that. So therefore, a lot of our public services are suffering.
This is kind of an interesting slide from my viewpoint, because being from Eastern Oregon, I just thought, well, you know, the big impact was probably on the east side of the mountains, but when you look at it, it's really on the, it's right there.
His district and my district.
Right there, Representative Hillcrest. And this thing shows that those circles indicate the mills have been shut down, and we've lost a little over 24,000 jobs, and, you know, it's pretty significant impact on what we're doing. And this slide shows statewide timber harvest, the top line at the 10,000, that's actually 10 million cubic feet of potential material that's produced. That's on a sustainable basis. You can see the next line down that falls very sharply is that's our federal cut. And you can see that we came down about 1991 where we made a significant reduction. Interesting to note that the private and the state forest harvest have stayed pretty much the same in all those years. This is a Forest Service and drop in employment. You can see that it's gone down substantially since the 1990 area, and that's taking jobs and taxes away from all of our public resources. This is just a slide. I think Senator Morris has a probably a good slide on this thing, too. Basically, that our ability to fund these public services is actually staying pretty even and actually has gone down some little bit. So my theory is a new circle of prosperity, we ought to create opportunities for Oregonians, and that will in turn create a clean, appealing environment, and that will add to diverse, well-paying jobs. So I think that the first slide, or the first circle of prosperity, has the priorities wrong. We got to create opportunities for Oregonians, and what do we do well in Oregon? We grow trees. And this is kind of an interesting slide, too, is the counties in the state of Oregon that actually really depend high upon forest industry. And you can notice along the Columbia River and in southeast Oregon, there's less, that's the lighter green. But at probably the majority, probably two-thirds of the states has a huge reliance upon the forest sector share of traded employment. So, you know, it is an important part to our economy. Okay, job multipliers for Oregon's forest sector. I mean, if your primary products, you almost have almost a 3-to-1. So for every job you create in the forest industry, you create almost 3 jobs outside of that. So, you know, this is a crucial thing for us. So I think the next ones are just cups of papers. You know, if we actually were cutting to the Forrest-Clinton plan, we'd be cutting about a billion board feet more of lumber. We'd be taking care of a lot of this problem. And I think this is what this bill is getting to, trying to get to at least a billion board feet. Okay, the Bush administration is doing some things. And the last one is a forest policy beyond salvage. You know, we have a lot of fights. We got to get past that. We got to start doing some things that actually create some jobs. So that's my presentation from that viewpoint. We heard this bill over in the Senate, and it came out and on a good vote. I think there's some recognition that this is a solution to a problem. The House's amendment, I've seen amendments. I would ask this committee to pass those amendments out, the dash fours, keep the process moving, and just move forward with it. I mean, we're talking about words, some of the words uncharacteristic, severe versus catastrophic. In the final analysis, these contracts will be subject to the review of the federal government, and the federal government will really be defining these terms. And so that's the position I'm taking, and I think we just need to get this position out. If you read Dean Saulwasher's letter, I think he really puts it out. I mean, he's an unbiased person in this thing. He just realizes that our forests are in serious trouble, and we need to do something about it. So I appreciate your attention and willingness to hear this bill, and any questions I'd be more than willing to have answered.
Okay, questions for the senator? Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Burley, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Burley, Chuck Burley from House District 54, and I'll be very brief. I just first of all want to thank Senator Nelson for bringing this bill forward. It's a very good idea. I think that the Department of Forestry also should be commended in this process, because they have taken a very strong leadership role in this whole process ever since the National Fire Plan was first adopted and the Healthy Forest Initiative, Healthy Forest Restoration Act, these types of initiatives. ODF has done a very good job working with both federal and non-federal landowners and trying to implement that, get as many dollars as they can through NFP grants and that type of stuff, and get some of this work done on the ground. And I think that what Senate Bill 1072 helps us do is get the state more engaged in these federal land issues by asking the Board of Forestry to take a greater role in it, coordinating the state agencies and their input to the process as well as the public process. But I think at the same time as we do that, we shouldn't be tying the Board of Forestry's hands. We need to let them go forward, let the process work. And you got to remember there's two separate processes here. There's what the state would be doing as well as what the federal agencies already are mandated to do, and Senator Nelson already referred to that. But I think that the underlying policy here with this bill, which I wholeheartedly endorse, is that we're trying to encourage the development of markets and utilization of biomass, because there's so much out there right now. Our forests are so overstocked, and this is evidenced by the extensive and very catastrophic and damaging fires that we're having now, that we need to work at getting some of this fuels out. And unfortunately, this stuff doesn't pay to get it out of the woods. So there's a great deal of effort going on trying to figure out what types of markets we can have and develop and what's cost effective. And I think this bill helps move that forward. And I'd also like to just point out, so that you don't spend too much time, I think you've got two amendments in front of you, one that was handwritten by myself, and then you've got the -4 LC draft, which should be the same. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Representative Burley, can you describe a little bit in detail what you are trying to get at with your amendments? There were some places in the bill that you and I discussed, one of them in the back about socially acceptable and gobbledygook. And if it isn't corrected, this bill isn't going to go anywhere, I'll tell you that, and it's going to happen quick.
I believe, Mr. Chair, that you're talking about in the A engrossed version, what would be Section 3, Sub 7, where biomass is defined, and that definition includes the words, without diminishing the biological productivity of the land, providing conservation of mature trees and old growth, and taking into consideration other things, including social acceptability. And in the -A4 amendment, I tried to in the A4 amendment, I changed the definition of biomass to be more consistent with the definition of biomass in other bills, not only that we're seeing this session here in Salem, but also some legislation that Congress is looking at as far as the National Energy Bill and some other things. So I was just trying to put it together so we're being a little bit more consistent across the board.
And we got it. I've got it here now. Just let me check a second. And the Section 7 on page 3 of the original A engrossed, the bottom of the page, that paragraph that goes over to page 8,
mm-hmm.
You've removed that. Is that correct?
That's correct. If you look on the A4 amendments, page 3, lines 22 through 30 is what I'm offering as the definition for biomass and woody biomass.
Okay. Okay, committee members, do you have any questions of Representative Burley?
Mr. Chair, I still need some more orientation. What's the general thrust and purpose of the A4 amendments? And forgive me if you're having to repeat what you told us earlier, but I'm starting to get up to speed here.
To clean up some of the language such that we're focusing on in my mind, we're trying to focus on encouraging the biomass markets for utilizing this material, which right now there is no market for it. I mean, there's the Warm Springs, for example, are very interested in trying to put in a cogen facility to burn this and produce electricity. There are several bills that they're working. The biofuels package has a lot of this biomass in there as well. And I think that by the A4 amendments here would help be more consistent with some of those efforts. There's also some question about the different, some of the words in here, uncharacteristic, which I think is something which is rather hard to define, although one could argue it's always the word severe and catastrophic. But those terms are the ones that are more often used in the literature that you typically would see with this.
A follow-up, if I could, Mr. Chair. So just to sort of what appears, Representative, is that you're trying to bring a more of a technician's eye to the product. Is that what I'm following here? That it's to make it fit with your. I know you bring a lot of experience in forest products to your service here, and it's to square with your understanding of the issues. Is that, do you understand that correctly?
That's a fair assessment. That plus, again, I'm trying to, for example, with the definition of biomass, trying to have some consistency between some of the other bills that we're looking at and what's being discussed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, can I just... Go ahead. Representative Burley, on page 4 of the Engross Section 4, whenever I see references in state statute to federal provisions without having read them, I get real uneasy because I was a member of the Board of Forestry for 6 years. I saw us fall into traps routinely. And it says that the state forester shall actively utilize the statutory provision of the National Management Forestry Management Act and on and on and on, and state participate in federal policy development in a manner to express the policy established in Section 3. Does that really serve any purpose?
I believe it does, because it brings, what it does is it says there are a lot of statutes out there already that govern not only how the federal land management agencies have to manage their land, but also how they have to involve states, tribes, local governments, and the public. For example, the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, there's a great deal of public process that bill mandates. The Healthy Forest Restoration Act of 2003, for example, encourages the development of community wildfire protection plans, which is something that the Department of Forestry has been very actively engaged in. Many of our counties throughout the state have been very actively participating in developing such community wildfire protection plans. And I think what that paragraph is saying is that the Board of Forestry needs to utilize those provisions and those statutes that allow for the state to get involved and do it to the maximum extent practical.
Okay. Senator Nelson, you had something you want to bring forward?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to answer Representative McPherson's question. I mean, you were talking, the term that was concerned you that the amendment took out was socially, what was that term?
It's referred to as gobbledygook.
Socially acceptability.
Tell me how you're going to ever define that without going to court.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what the amendments are trying to do. Is, I mean, the situation we've got ourselves in this whole thing is that we end up in lawsuits over words like this. And this actually was a concern that was expressed by the Department of Forestry, too, saying, well, you know, how do I define socially acceptable? And the bottom line that I have on this thing is the federal government is basically going to dictate the terms of this under these stewardship contracts. They're going to come out and say, you can do this, you cannot do that. And there's about 80 of these projects. They are working, I understand. And Utah and Colorado have some form of it. And going back to Dean Sawwasher's statement, he said, we just need some bold action here and try and get past all this lawsuit stuff. So we actually get out and try to take care of some of our forests. That's if that's clarifying, I don't.
Okay, anything further?
I guess I do have another question, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Sure.
I guess I'm confused about whether we're talking about forest issues, but then I see the definition of biomass seems so broad. It includes both woody biomass, which is a lot of which the definition of which is forest related. But I see a lot of things here: agricultural crops, plants, grasses, animal waste, municipal waste. I see a lot of things that aren't forest related in the bill. So and yet we have the Department of Forestry overseeing this effort. So I'm trying to connect the dots here.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson. If you'll look at the -A4 amendments on page 3, again, lines 22 through 30, you'll notice that I'm offering actually two definitions. One for biomass, which is the more inclusive, as you pointed out, from the A and Gross version. But then the second one, the woody biomass definition, is a subset of that. Mm-hmm. And the reason I did that is if you'll look through, which I'm not asking to take the time now, but sections 4, we're asking the Board of Forestry to specifically focus on the woody biomass aspect of it, because we wouldn't expect them to deal with the agricultural and aquatic plants and that type of stuff, but focus on the woody biomass aspect. That's why I did that.
I have a question to follow up to that, which might be explanatory, because for God knows reasons we had several of these in revenue. And Representative Burley is correct, and I'm reading this verbiage, that in your testimony and the work that we did in the private forest partnership deal and in the biofuels bill, these definitions seem to match those amendments and that verbiage you brought forward, so that those three bills are almost compatible and identical, it appears to me. Is that correct?
That's the intent, yes.
Anything further? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I have Marianne Guest and Mrs. Doug Hyken, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Marianne Guest, representing the Wild Salmon Center. First, I'd like to commend Senator Nelson for his interest in this important issue and for bringing us all to the table to try to come to some consensus around this new technology, the use of biomass. We support the use of biomass as an alternative energy source, but caution that biomass removal from our forests may not be the magic cure-all it's suggested to be. First, we'd like to point out that fire is not catastrophic. This term was in the original bill and was removed by Senate amendments. That term is unnecessarily inflammatory and continues the all fire is bad thinking that has created many of our current forest health challenges. Fire has played an important role in the development of aquatic and riparian systems, particularly in the western United States. A central strategy of the Natural Fire Plan and the Healthy Forest Initiative is fuel reduction through small diameter logging. I say small diameter logging and underbrush removal. The motivation is to reduce the potential risk of catastrophic fire, yet fuels treatment can cause considerable disturbance and must be weighed against the risk of fire damage to watersheds and riparian areas. In our exuberance to manage our way out of problems, we must make sure we don't create more problems through overly active management. Senate Bill 1072 adds another resource extraction industry to Oregon's Department of Forestry's mission that is already struggling, as well we all know in this building, to find balance between timber harvesting and the environment. While such a mission may be one of the one the department may ultimately excel at, it is imperative that we approach these new programs with a sense of caution and humility. Additionally, any investments in biomass infrastructure should reflect the temporary nature of the problem and the proposed solutions. If 60 years ago our predecessors had known that permanent dams and their associated reservoirs would help drive our salmon and steelhead runs to the brink of extinction and further impoverish Native American communities, they may have acted more cautiously. It would be a mistake to turn our forests into the equivalent of manufacturing components as we have our rivers. We oppose the bill's current definition of biomass. And I know you're talking about the Dash 4 amendments, which are, which we would strongly oppose. The current definition should not include, and we argued about this in the Senate, should not include municipal waste, black liquor, or trees that are important to the health of forest, water quality, and fish and wildlife habitat. I've done some research in the local Region E accreditation criteria memo of understanding that was dated January 5th, 2005 between the Pacific Northwest stakeholders, which are Bonneville, Pacific Northwest Generating Cooperative, Pacific Core PGE, and the Center for Resource Solutions has determined that the certification for renewable energy certification in the Pacific Northwest is based on the following definition of biomass. Biomass energy based on solid organic fuels from wood, forest or field residues or dedicated energy crops that do not include wood pieces that have been treated with chemical preservatives such as creosote, I can't say the other word, or copper chrome arsenic, municipal solid waste, tires, or black liquor. Renewable Northwest calls black liquor one of the most unsustainable of biomass. Black liquor is the pulping process residue remaining after removal of the cellulose for paper making. The International Federation of Chemical, Energy, Mine, and General Workers Union has put out a health and safety hazard warning regarding black liquor. It states, black liquor generated during the production of viscose pulp may have mutagenic effects, and black liquor obtained from the production of paper pulp is characterized by mutagenic as well as carcinogenic effects. In addition, black liquor can rapidly cause devastating thermal corrosive burns to the skin, eyes, lung, and upper gastrointestinal tract. By excluding black liquor and municipal waste from the definition of biomass in this bill, the legislature is not banning its use in biomass plants, because I understand it's currently used. It's just telling ODF to focus their promotional efforts on biomass fuels that are less toxic and less controversial. Senate Bill 1072 is really about two issues, and these could be dealt with separately, and the fact is that both of these issues in federal lands and also biomass production don't need legislation. There's no need actually for legislation. These can be currently done right now. The bill just adds weight and momentum to the issue, which we're somewhat reluctant to jump on board with. From our perspective, to imagine a new economic sector based on logging and burning trees, even with environmental safeguards, is problematic. We do not want to add another problem to an already entrenched situation. We urge the committee to bolster the environmental safeguards and to direct Oregon state agencies to move cautiously when helping to manage lands that belong to all Americans. Thank you.
My name is Doug Hyken. I'm with Oregon Natural Resources Council. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today. Oregon Natural Resources Council has a membership of over 5,000 people who support our mission to protect and restore Oregon's wildlands, wildlife, and water as an enduring legacy. This bill has two parts. The first part directs Oregon Department of Forestry to promote the use of biomass. And the second part puts Oregon Department of Forestry in a special role with relationship to federal lands. The first part of the bill regarding biomass, we can support if it's done very carefully. We think that biomass utilization needs to be done in the context of restoration. Our forests are suffering from decades of inappropriate management, and we think that there is a lot of important work that needs to be done in our forests. Removing fuels is one of those things, and so when biomass utilization is done as part of a restoration program, it can benefit our forests and create jobs and reduce fire hazard and so on. So that's a good thing. We also feel that biomass utilization must be conservatively scaled. This is very important because we don't want to build plants that are too large that then creates an unsustainable demand from our forests, which would just make the situation worse instead of better. There's economies of scale involved with these biomass energy plants, and so there's a tendency to want to build them larger to keep those fixed costs down. But there's risks in doing that, so we really feel it's important that we leave the terminology conservative scaled in there. We need to recognize that biomass utilization does have possible adverse impacts. We're talking about putting heavy equipment in the woods and modifying the habitat of species and changing the soil structure and possibly causing water quality and other impacts. So we can't ignore the fact that there are both negative and positive impacts here, and we need to think about both of them as we move forward. In fact, if we too aggressively remove biomass, we could end up logging old-growth forests, which is not going to make the fire situation better. In fact, it could make it worse. So if we have too broad of a definition of biomass, that's going to be a serious problem. There's going to be public opposition, and there's going to be a worse ecological outcome. So that's why this bill needs to be very carefully constrained. The second part of the bill, which puts Oregon Department of Forestry in a special role with respect to federal forests, concerns us greatly, and we do not support this part of the bill. The federal forests are managed under a multiple-use mandate that includes water quality, wildlife, recreation, wood products, range, scenery, wilderness, all these different values. Oregon Department of Forestry is not an agency that is used to managing in that framework. And so we think that the Oregon Department of Forestry's bias towards resource exploitation does not make it specially suited to dealing with these federal land issues. We think it's best to leave the governor with all the discretion to appoint whoever he or she thinks is most appropriate to deal with different issues that come up on federal lands. If it's a water quality issue, maybe DEQ is the best agency. If it's a wildlife issue, maybe Fish and Wildlife is the best agency. So now I'd like to discuss briefly some of our biggest concerns with the amendments. On page 2, line 32, we're going to change the definition of stewardship contracting. But in fact, this section of the bill comes directly out of federal law, and we're attempting to eliminate the term small diameter trees, which is a requirement in federal law that these stewardship contracts focus on the removal of small diameter trees. So I don't think the state is in a good position to be changing federal law here or to be broadening the scope of these federal stewardship contracts. So we urge that we stick to the original language there. Page 3, line 36, removes the terms conservatively scaled from the biomass policy. And we think it's very important that we leave that in there. Hal Salwasser, in a big meeting we had a month or so ago here in this building, was very clear that he thought a conservatively scaled approach was the right way to go. And that's what he had in mind when they were designing the Lakeview project. On page 4, line 19, we're deleting public education and public outreach about the consequences of the potential consequences of biomass utilization. We think we need to have open eyes here and look at both the positive and the negative impacts of biomass utilization, and not just focus on the positive benefits, which there are some, and we recognize that, but we also want to recognize that there are negative impacts. We could be making fire risk worse. We could be dirtying our water quality and harming habitat. So let's find the right balance by looking at all the impacts. Page 4, line 43, also has the same thing. We need to have the ODF reporting every 3 years on potential negative impacts and on the benefits, not just looking at one side of the equation. Let's look at a complete balance sheet, not just half of it. And then to address this issue of social acceptability, the reason that term was in there is because we want to encourage Oregon Department of Forestry to listen to the public. We want to avoid controversy as much as possible here so that biomass utilization can move forward. It's very important that it does move forward, but it needs to be done carefully. So if we can avoid controversial areas like roadless areas, then we're more likely to have success. And social acceptability was just a shorthand way of saying, let's listen to the public. There's not going to be lawsuits about that term. We're talking here about ODF promoting biomass utilization. They're going to put out pamphlets and brochures and have meetings. No one's going to file a lawsuit to stop the meeting, call it to a halt, because they didn't talk about social acceptability enough. We're just putting in some encouraging words for Oregon Department of Forestry to listen to the public. And on the issue of catastrophic fire versus uncharacteristic fire, this is not a big deal, but in our view, catastrophic fire is an ambiguous term. Does it mean the fire caused loss of life? That's what a fireman thinks, usually. Intense fires are, in fact, natural in some areas, and they can't really be stopped. In the Coast Range of Oregon, there are catastrophic fires, but they only occur every 300 years. And we shouldn't really be targeting our biomass utilization on forests like that and trying to stop a natural process from occurring once every 300 years. So uncharacteristic, we think, is a better term because it focuses our efforts where the treatments are really needed. Those drier forests that evolved with a more frequent fire regime and have fuels that are built up to an unnatural degree and cause uncharacteristic fires, those are the areas where our fuel reduction efforts will be most effective and are most important. Uncharacteristic is also it's a more scientifically accurate term. And it's also used in the state of Oregon's Comprehensive Wildlife Conservation Plan. That's the term used throughout that plan. They don't use the word catastrophic fire. It's also used in the National Fire Plan. So there is a good record for the use of the term uncharacteristic. Now, if these amendments are adopted, I think that this bill will be opposed by conservation groups. So I encourage you to try to stick to the original bill as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Committee members, have any questions?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hyken, I haven't found the socially acceptable language. Where
that is at the very top of page 4, lines 1 and 2. So in the definition of biomass, we're encouraging that social acceptability be one of the considerations when ODF promotes the use of biomass.
Okay, further question. I'm sensing that at least as to some of the changes, there were modifications made in the Senate to make the bill more acceptable to the natural resource advocates, and that the one aspect of the A4 is that it would be then removing some of that language or going back to some original language.
Correct.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, another question, if I could. You refer to Section 4 as being governing state foresters' role with federal lands, but I'm not understanding why this necessarily relates to federal timberlands as opposed to just timberlands generally. Any place where woody biomass would be found, even private timberlands.
This might be confusion. The earliest versions of this bill had sections 3 and 4 were about Oregon Department of Forestry's role in federal forests, and later they were switched. And so that might be the source of the confusion. But, yeah, the biomass part of the bill appropriately should apply to biomass wherever it occurs. You know, we should be acquiring that from private land, state land, federal land, wherever. And it should be used for a variety of purposes, not just energy generation, but there are existing businesses and industries in Oregon that utilize this small diameter material for fence posts, poles, firewood, pulp, and so on. And we shouldn't discriminate against those existing businesses or new ones that might want to start by focusing too much on energy.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask another question.
All right.
Looks to me as though in the A4 amendments, Section 4, which is what tells the state forester to do certain things, I would read that as applying to woody biomass wherever it is present in the state.
I agree.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other further questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to continue on this bill until we're done or get called to the floor, so the longer we speak, the longer we sit. Charlie Stone, I'm going to ask you to come up. You aren't signed up, but there's a couple clarifications that I want to make. I have you, Mike. Don't mean to put you on the spot. But
that's all right, Mr. Chair.
Can you identify yourself?
For the record, Charlie Stone with the Department of Forestry Fire Protection Program.
Now, off the top of your head, I ask you a question. Basically, why are the negative conditions that we see on the federal lands for the most part not present on private lands in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, I'd say that the major difference between those two ownerships is that the private lands are most normally actively managed, and fuel is removed, forests are thinned. The buildup that would otherwise occur in terms of biomass is systematically removed through management activities. And while that's generally not the case anymore on the federal forests.
Okay. Also, because there are some references to state lands as far as biomass, and there were some statements made about the effects of forestry on other natural resources, water, wildlife, air. Can you tell us real briefly what the FPFO is? And maybe, I know right off the top of their head, you may not remember it, because I've been trying to remember it, and I can't. We had a vision statement, an objective statement, and something up there, and we update that, and we move it as the technology and the science tells us how to better do the job of management. And that was a focal point for the department, the board. You could just kind of address it basically a little bit.
Well, I will try. First of all, FPFO, as you mentioned, that's the acronym for the Forestry Program for Oregon, and that is the Board of Forestry's strategic plan for guiding forest policy in the state of Oregon. I can't very well today paraphrase or describe the board's mission statement. I know that the department's mission statement, which has been separate from that in the past, is to protect, manage, and promote healthy forestry for the state, to create healthy forests and to provide benefits for all the people of the state of Oregon today and tomorrow. I think that's relatively close to what the board's position has been, but by and large, the Forestry Program for Oregon looks at several different areas in the forest and attempts to provide for sustainability, which is in all areas of economics, the environment, and social sustainability, because they all rely on each other.
Also, there were some comments made, would you clarify if you could, about the department's forestry management guidance. What are the tools that we use to guide forest management in Oregon as far as regulatory on both private lands and state forest lands?
Well, Mr. Chair, the primary regulatory mechanism is the Oregon Forest Practices Act, which is the first of its kind in the nation. It's been around for 30-plus years now, and it establishes minimum standards for the management of all lands in terms of harvest practices, road construction practices, requires reforestation, regulates the use of chemicals, the disposal of slash. It is a very progressive regulatory mechanism that provides for clean water, clean air, maintenance of fish and wildlife.
That was the objective, the last three things that you mentioned.
Yes.
Okay. Also, the mention of whether or not the Department of Forestry had an open public process. You talk about the process that's used, the public hearings on administrative rules, that type of thing.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Of course, all of our rulemaking is governed by the Administrative Procedures Act, which requires hearings and open process, but the Board of Forestry goes well beyond that in terms of its activities whenever they're discussing any type of policy development. Rulemaking or not, they always welcome the public. They hold there's about 7 or 8 Board of Forestry meetings each year. The reason that I'm here talking to you today instead of the folks that really know about this bill is because there's a Board of Forestry meeting going on right now in Central Oregon. every topic on the, unless it's dealing with the, you know, specific hearing or rulemaking has already closed, they always invite testimony on the subjects. They bring up a lot of the subjects specifically to involve the public. And it's again, one of the key pieces of the forestry program for Oregon is to promote public involvement.
Okay. Committee members, do you have any questions? Mr. Stone?
I do, Mr. Chair. Just briefly,
McPherson.
Mr. Stone, this Section 4, sort of the operative language of the bill, directs the state forester to do certain things with respect to all the forests of the state, including federal forests. What authority does the state forester and the Board of Forestry have over federal forests?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, the department in current statute doesn't have any authority per se over federal forest land. The Board of Forestry is given the responsibility to supervise all matters of forest policy in the state of Oregon. That's part of their statutory mandate. And that's actually been something that's been discussed in the forestry program for Oregon and a lot of our implementation plans and whatnot. The board has a responsibility to deal with policies and to try and influence them wherever they are, including the federal lands. The department in its programs that are, you know, specifically mandated and budgeted for deal with fire protection on private and state lands. We can cooperate with the federal government to accomplish those goals. The regulatory elements are aimed at the private lands and the state lands, and our forestry assistance programs deal with the private lands. So there isn't any specific authority to, and in my reading of this bill, it doesn't give us any kind of management authority over the federal lands or any direction. What sub 1 of Section 4 appears to me to be trying to do is to carry out the board's responsibility and have take a greater effort to participate and try to influence the federal decisions. But those decisions and actions are still the federal government's for sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you.
Sorry to put you on the spot, but
not a problem. I came here because I knew that you might have questions.
Okay, thank you. Can we have Jim Geisinger come up, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Geisinger. I represent the Associated Oregon Loggers. We're a trade association representing about 1,100 small family-owned businesses involved in the logging businesses and businesses associated with logging. I'll accept your challenge and keep my comments just as brief as I can. We're in full support of Senate Bill 1072 with the A4 amendments. We came prepared about a month ago to support Senator Nelson's bill in the Senate Rules Committee, and that very day, -2 and then subsequently -3 amendments emerged, and many of those did concern us, and I would like to comment on that briefly. But before I do, this really is a historic attempt to get the state more engaged in managing our federal forests, and while there is no statutory authority to do so, the fact is almost 58% of our forest lands in this state are owned by the federal government, and I think it is the responsibility of the state to exercise some kind of oversight on how those lands are managed. And frankly, the Forest Service is shell-shocked after 15 years of litigation and challenges to their management decisions that I really think they need a catalyst to get back into the business of managing these forests. I think they're afraid of their own shadow right now, and with some guidance and some support from the state of Oregon, I think they can get back to being the good stewards of the land that they were at one time. We commend Senator Nelson for his efforts. I think his PowerPoint presentation did an excellent job of documenting the need for this legislation. But let me comment briefly on the amendments that occurred between the time his bill was introduced in the Senate Rules Committee and the time that it emerged from it. There is great significance to the terminology that emerged through the deliberation on the Senate side. Most of these amendments, in our view, are intended to constrain and obstruct the efforts to restore the health of our forests and to reduce forest fuels to a manageable level. They are intended to tie the hands of land managers tighter, not to loosen them, and it's an effort to limit the scope and scale of the effort to restore the health of our federal forests. Terms like uncharacteristic wildfire or uncharacteristic insect and disease infestations, references to the removal of biomass prefaced by the word excessive, the elimination of large trees from the definition of biomass. Large trees are just as, a dead large tree can be just as hazardous to the future vulnerability of a forest to catastrophic fire as small trees. The social acceptability comment has been mentioned several times. Now, anyone that doesn't think that these are issues that would appear in litigation has not been following history on how our federal forests are managed. As we sit here, 1.6 billion board feet of federal timber sales are in federal court being legally challenged. That is almost 1 year's worth of the Forest Service's national timber sale program. And I can assure you the nature of these challenges isn't about whether or not timber sales are environmentally harmful or environmentally benign, whether or not they're good or bad. They're all being challenged on procedural laws and regulations that the federal land management agencies have been given over the course of several decades to adhere to. I can guarantee you that legal challenges would occur over whether or not a biomass project was addressing excessive biomass or normal biomass, or whether restoring the land after a wildfire and whether that fire was uncharacteristic or otherwise natural. These legal challenges would occur, and I think it's very important to face that reality. We've been dealing with that kind of those kinds of legal challenges for many decades now. The second and final comment I'd like to make relative to the concerns expressed about the A4 amendments is to remind the committee that this law, SB 1072, does not supplant any federal law. The Forest Service is still going to have to comply with all the laws and regulations that they're currently required to adhere to, whether it's the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act, the National Forest Management Act, or the National Environmental Policy Act. So this is to supplement and improve upon the management and the laws and regulations that the Forest Service has to adhere to. So with that, I would very much encourage you to pass Senate Bill 1072 with the A4 amendments. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions, committee members?
I do have.
That's right. Don't run away, Jim. First off, I want to save the Forestry Department. They are not the Forest Service. They're the Forestry Department, as you well know. There's a whole lot of difference because I have the Forest Service on the edge of my property, and if they manage their pine beetle and they manage their forest practices the way we had to in the state of Oregon, I wouldn't have lost so much money in the last 2 years. But I do have a question. Regards to the A4 and the if it's amended into there, are there other key issues that you see in there that ought to be addressed or ought not to be addressed or ought to be amended?
The A4 amendments pretty much address the concerns that we had. We are very supportive of the intent of the original bill. Our enthusiasm waned as the amendments were adopted on the Senate side, but I think the A4 amendments prepared by Representative Burley do a pretty good job of addressing our concerns, and with those amendments, we would fully support this legislation.
Great. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Jim. Have Lee Hazelwood, Diana Enright, and Mike Sullivan, please. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Diane Enright, Assistant Director, Oregon Department of Energy. The Oregon Department of Energy would like to go on record in support of this bill, Senate Bill 1072. The state's recently released Renewable Energy Action Plan calls for emphasis on all renewable resource development, including forest biomass utilization. We often say that Oregon is fossil fuel poor but rich in renewable resources, and this bill could help identify a source and supply for forest biomass. Recovering forest waste for energy ties with our agency's incentive programs, which help to produce renewable energy by and for Oregonians. Thank you.
Well, there's someone that knows how to testify quickly. You've done the best of everybody today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lee Hazelwood. I'm a senior advocate, and I live in Staten, Oregon. I'm here to support Senate Bill 1072 today's for amendment. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I first visited Oregon in 1972 and was immediately impressed, not just with the beauty of Oregon, but the active commerce that was visible throughout the state. While lumber mills and timber-related companies were an active part of many communities, other parts of the state had huge agriculture areas dedicated to food and grain production. It was exhilarating to see these industries providing employment using renewable resources. Oregon was a vibrant economic contributor to our country. Shortly after moving permanently to Oregon in 1978, I said, as many others, as special interest groups began to tear apart the foundation of our state, and environmental groups tied knots in the timber industry, employment regulations eliminated a large portion of young farm workers, and mobile layer lawsuits slowly drained away the marginal finances resources of those industries. In their wake, we were left with mostly log exports, chip production, a few large agribusinesses. These losses were just not in the employment sector. They caused a significant reduction in tax money that these industries contributed to the state's economy. The continual reduction in timber monies helped start the long downward spiral that eventually put our schools, senior and disabled programs, and emergency service providers in constant fiscal crisis. I do want to thank Senator Berger for speaking up on the Senate floor about this bill, and she talked about the money that eventually would go to the Common School Fund. And naturally, I have an interest in that because I have a daughter-in-law as a school teacher. But Alaska has oil, which produces a significant amount of revenue. Wyoming has coal and natural gas resources and has a large surplus in revenue. Nevada has the gaming industry producing large amounts of revenue. Oregon has one of the largest natural sustainable resources, and it's called timber. Using more of this renewable resource means jobs, and that's spelled J-O-B-S. More jobs means more revenue for the state. This is the reason I'm supporting Senate Bill 1072-4, and I'd like to thank Senator Nelson and Representative Burley for bringing this bill to the position it is in now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee, for the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I do legislative affairs for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Western Industrial Council, which supports Senate Bill 1072-4. We want to thank Senator Nelson for his efforts on this. This is a good bill. It will create good jobs, and it's a very, very good idea. I don't have to touch on a job loss in the state. I think that Senator Nelson did a very good job. When this was on the Senate side in the Subcommittee on Natural Resources, the Budget Subcommittee, as Senator Bates said, he doesn't have too much problem with the way the state forests are being managed, but the federal forests are quite another problem. And probably the only way to really manage it would be to put up a firewall. There is a need for this kind of work, this restoration work. It would create really good jobs that we have lost over the years, and I don't need to tell anyone in this room how desperately we need more good jobs. So with that, I'll close, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Committee members, do you have any questions of the panel? Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A4 amendments into SB 1072A. Excuse me, is it the B4?
A4.
A4. That's right. Thank you. Rarely.
Okay, Representative Boquist has moved the A4 amendments in Senate Bill 1072. Any objections?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to object to the amendments. And it's not that I'm convinced that there's a problem with them necessarily, but we have a bill that's been tugged in different directions here, and there's some sort of charged language in an area that's very sensitive, and I think to get what appears to be a good bill through, we would be assuring its passage more expeditiously if we didn't move those amendments.
Okay, take note.
I want to address that.
Andrew Boquist.
I'm not going to let that pass. Three or four things in the A4 that I think you need to address, Mr. Chair, and I'm speaking now as the Vice Chairman of Agriculture and Natural Resources, and we heard all this issue on our committee before. We've been through all this. I mean, one thing that jumps out right off the bat is that we have a serious problem of trying to get state, federal, and private coordination. The private property owners, down to the farmers and the rural and even urban owners, and the state landowners trying to get the federal government to comply with basic forest practices and basic habitat management. It's been a disaster. My own property is a prime example. That's a case where we have pine beetle infestation on U.S. Forest Service property in which they fail to address the issue, which then comes over onto our private land, which then goes on to Boise Cascade, and then, funny enough, infected a larger tract of their land. And that's just one of examples of three that I have that I'm personally dealt with and that this bill starts to address. Second issue is social acceptability doesn't equate public input. I mean, of all the departments we oversee at Ag and Natural Resources Committee, the Department of Forestry is probably the most open. And the fact that they haven't been drugged into as much litigation as the U.S. Forest Service has is amazing. And that's because they have public input. And for the social acceptability to be kind of plugged in there right next to the verbiage of vegetation growth rates and then say it's public input, it's horse bucky is what it is. I mean, no two ways about it. The last thing that really bothers me is that when we stray across the line here and we start getting input, and input from everybody is important and everybody needs to be at the table, but we suddenly have gone from the point of view where 5 years ago what was an environmental group is now a conservationist, and there are in fact definitive different groups. Just because fundraising happens to be more convenient when you call yourself a conservationist doesn't change the basis of what your beliefs are. And I'll bring a prime example. I have a piece of property in a county in this state in which it's very ironic. There are members of what I would have 10 years ago said the environmental left wing who are now aligned with the farmers who are against what are now some of the conservation groups which are again against. So everything gets mixed up very quickly here. And what we really need to focus on is pick the public policy, we're going to do it, make it a good public policy and go forward. And sometimes there comes the case that you water it down so much it doesn't do any good. And so that's why I support the A4.
Okay. Anything further? A4s, I believe we put them in, didn't we? Now they're in.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1072 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
To budget.
Actually, referring it to budget.
To budget. Okay, Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1072 as amended to the Budget Committee with a due pass. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be a no vote today, just to register concern, because I'm just learning about this bill and the issues really for the first time here this morning, and so I, just to register that concern, I'll be a no vote, but I don't know how I'll vote one way or the other.
I'll take you out to dinner and we'll talk.
Okay. Fair enough.
And I'll go with it.
As long as I pay.
Okay, thank you.
Good idea. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Boquist.
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 1072A, as amended, is moved to the Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session on 1072. The people from the nursing groups are here. We're going to go ahead and see if we can go quick. They said 5 minutes. I'm going to time them. They assured us. So we will open a public hearing and a work session on Senate Bill 1016. And Senator, I appreciate you being patient.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing us to present this bill or bring it back. Senate Bill 1016 actually deals with the nursing shortage, and as you all know, it's critical here in Oregon as well as across the nation. I'm not going to go into that. I think you already know that we have a nursing shortage. But this legislature, in the past, in 2003, has acknowledged the nursing shortage with Senate Bill 800. Unfortunately, it was not funded, but that has not stopped the nursing leadership from going forward, developing a strategic plan to address the nursing shortage, and they have done that, and we have some nursing leaders here. They have actually used Northwest Health Foundation monies to pursue this, but now that money is starting to go away, and they are being very innovative on raising money because they have already been so successful in addressing the nursing shortage already in the state of Oregon. And they do have a report that they can give to each one of you if you want to see the summary of that. This bill went away because it was a mandatory fee, and I want to thank Representative Richardson for doing the work that he did. He actually sent a survey out to the various nurses, and he said, Lori, the responses I got back were most of the nurses did not want to have a mandatory fee in order to get their nursing license. And so this B5 amendment, what it does is when a nurse or an LPN renews or applies for their nursing license, they can make a voluntary contribution into the Oregon State Board of Nursing Workforce Center Fund. This is a new fund, and it will be specifically used to address the Oregon nursing workforce shortage. I agree with this. I talked to Representative Richardson first to make sure it was okay with him, and he said absolutely if it's voluntary, and we will leave it up to the Board of Nursing to set that criteria on how they would do that with the nursing license. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Marna Flaherty-Robb, Associate Dean of the School of Nursing at Oregon Health and Science University, but I'm representing today Dr. Kathleen Potempa, President of the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council. I testify today in support of Senate Bill 1016 as the President of the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council. As you know, the ONLC consists of 5 member organizations: the Oregon Nurses Association, the Oregon Council of Deans, the Northwest Organization of Nurse Executives, the Oregon Community College Associate Degree Nursing Programs, and the Oregon State Board of Nursing. This group has worked since 1999 to define the critical needs of Oregon related to the nursing shortage. The ONLC has demonstrated consistently united leadership around issues of nursing education, nursing workforce development and investment, the importance of the Oregon Center for Nursing as a vehicle to manage significant projects related to workforce development. Senate Bill 1016 provides a mechanism to fund the necessary projects supported by the ONLC strategic plans of 2000 and recently renewed at 2005. The proposed amendments will change those plans. The original bill will have yielded roughly $400,000 per year, one penny a day by each working nurse, to support critical areas of workforce development outlined in the scope of the bill. The current amendments would give us an unknown amount of funding. However, it would give us some source of funding to keep the plan and actions moving forward. The annual amount will be appropriated through a contract application and review process that will assure alignment with the scope and priorities outlined in the bill. The original annual amount is completely consistent with other states that have centralized centers for workforce projects such as outlined here. In fact, there are 8. Washington is the 8th, and there are many others in queue. However, if these amendments are approved, we will have to rework that process, as noted by Senator Mona Sanderson. It is important to note that this bill is designed and supported by nurses through the nursing organizations and groups within the ONLC, as mentioned prior. The money proposed would come from nurses to support nursing's future as well as the future of health of Oregonians. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Faye Malius. I'm here as the Oregon Center for Nursing's board president, and I'm also here as the chairperson of the associate degree program at Lynn Benton Community College. I'm here to ask for your support for funding and some mechanism for the Center for Nursing, their efforts in what has happened over the last 4 years. The outcome of the Oregon Center's Nurse and the Oregon Nurse Leadership Council has been unprecedented in getting groups of nurses together to help solve the problems that are arising because of our demographics in Oregon and the changing in health care. Without some innovation and without some concerted effort to solve these issues on behalf of nursing, health care will be in a crisis situation. The Oregon Center for Nursing has had several outcomes over the last few years. One is a consortium of all nursing education programs in the state of Oregon, both four-year and two-year. We have not been at the same table ever together before working on issues of nursing education. We have the largest SIM alliance in the nation because of the efforts of the Oregon Nurse Leadership Council and the Oregon Center of Nursing. We also have had the largest technology and the largest workforce evaluation research project that has happened in the state of Oregon ever because of the efforts of the Oregon Center for Nursing. I just encourage you to pass Senate Bill 1016. Thank you for your time. I also support and thank Senator Moines Anderson and her efforts and her golfing. Thank you.
Brian. Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian DeLeichmann representing the Oregon Nurses Association. Let me spend about 2 minutes, and I won't be any longer than that. I've been lobbying for 28 years, and nursing shortages have been cyclical in that time period. But over the last 6 to 8 years, it's become very apparent that we're in what most of us consider a perfect storm. And you've probably heard a lot of this information, but a majority of our nurses are over 50 and are going to be leaving the practice. The available slots in our schools, for a number of reasons, but mainly lack of resources in this state and other states, is just not there. And so we are going to face a critical shortage, and I emphasize critical shortage, by the turn of the end of this decade. We have come before this legislature several sessions in a row, and as was mentioned last session, Senate Bill 800 was passed, which set up the mechanism that you're hearing about today, but it was not funded. We came back this time saying, okay, we need to take the next step. And the next step was to figure out some funding mechanism, and the nurses stepped up and said, we'll tax ourselves because it's very apparent we're not going to get resources out of the legislature for this project, at least at this point, understanding the physical constraint of 2 years ago, and then we're just pulling out of it. But the final point, I guess, that I would make is that this is not the end. The nurses are going to voluntarily try and step to the plate, but the resources that are needed for the type of endeavor that we're really looking at are far beyond any voluntary contributions that are going to be made by nurses. And I guess I would ask each one of you, I sat through the entire hearing this morning about Bandon Airport and everything else, mm-hmm. I would ask the chair to ask for $10 million from the speaker for this project for next session. We may not need the full 10, but you seem to have a pretty good way with getting money from the speaker. But I think there needs to be a resource allocation directly from the state. This is a problem that the state, it's not a problem for the nurses, other than they're overworked, they're leaving the practice. This is going to be a healthcare crisis in this state if we don't do anything. It's statewide significance. And so I would ask each and every one of you as we move forward to next session that you put this on your agenda to deal with the nursing shortage rather than putting it to the next session. Mm-hmm. And I would thank you and answer any questions.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Committee members, do you have any questions?
Mr. Chair. Just for Mr. DeLeichmann, so what is the ONA's position on the B5 amendments we have here?
As a member of the coalition, we're accepting the amendments. Obviously, in the series of preferences, it would have been some state funding, and then it was, okay, well, let's get the $20. We supported the $20 allocation. Then it was down to $8. Now it's a voluntary contribution. But understanding in order the ability to move forward on some mechanism, we would support the A5s.
I would add in support that we're hoping that in the implementation of this, with your support, in the checkoff box, there can be low and high numbers, so that people can go high as well. So we really do need more substantial funds, as is stated by everyone. Thank you so much.
Anything else from committee members? Just as a little note, just before I was starting my first campaign, I had to go in for, is it diverticulosis?
Yes.
Thought I was going to have a you-know-what, didn't.
Yeah.
I nicknamed my nurses the hunk, because there's a guy that was, you know, every man would like to be like this nurse, male nurse. I mean, this
12% in Oregon.
He obviously made an impression.
Yes. Squeaks when she walked, she squeaked, and then there was the gal that came in with a rubber glove every time. That was the Grim Reaper.
Yeah.
And another one I called Mom, but you know, they were all great to work with.
Wonderful.
Well, Mr. Chair, what we're asking here, I need $3 million for a river dredging. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A5 amendment into SB 1016.
Ruby Boquist has moved the A5 amendment into
B5.
Excuse me.
It's B.
B. Side bill 1016.
B5.
Any objections? Amendments in?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to...
I just squeaked, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to refer Senate Bill 1016 as amended to budget with a due pass.
Okay, Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1016 as amended to the Budget Committee with a due pass. Any conversation, objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Torres?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 1016B is amended and moves to the Budget Committee with a due pass. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1016. We'll adjourn the committee until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Thank you all.